Are you ready?
Activate.
Sequence start 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Shadows in the Dark. Well, I guess it has been quite some time since we've really kind of been on there. Of course, we had the 24-hour bash here recently, and if you missed that, we are going to be putting up those archives here very, very soon. It'll take us a little bit of time. It is 24 hours worth of audio that we'll have to go through, take care of, check out, take out some of the music, commercials, things like that. You know how it goes, and it's the third time we've done it, so many of you out there are familiar with it. Now, tonight's guest, he was just recently on the 24-hour broadcast with us, but we're going to bring him back tonight for our special, I'm not going to call it special, but it's a three-hour show tonight. If you didn't realize that, yes, we are on for 3 hours. And that is going to be Douglas Dietrich. He's been on the show quite a few times, and we're going to talk about Roswell. Was Roswell an alien crash, or was it possibly something else more earthly? We'll find that out here very soon, but I wanted to take this time, these first 15 or so minutes of the show, to talk about some of the things we do have going on, what we're going to be doing moving forward, all that kind of good stuff, because I know we really went into a lot of detail during the 24-hour bash, and some people, didn't quite make it to the bash, and, we just want to make sure everybody knows what exactly we are doing now. Shadows in the Dark will not be twice a week anymore, at least for right now. I don't know. We may go back to it at some point. Quite honestly, I'd love to do it 5 days a week. But it comes down to time, quite honestly. But we are going to broadcast every Sunday at 9 o'clock p.m. till midnight. So every Sunday we're going to do a three-hour show instead of two-hour shows. Now, what's that really mean? It means that we can have a lot of shows with two guests, or we can have a show with one guest. We're going to add some more segments to the show, and I've actually talked to a few people out there about some of the new segments I want to kind of introduce and kind of make a part of this. So we're going to start introducing those over time, and really, to be honest with you, get back into having a lot of fun. Someone here recently told me one of the worst things I could have done was take myself from behind this microphone. And, I got to thinking about that a little bit more and more because, I love this show. I love what we talk about. I have a really deep passion for all of this. And, that really rang kind of true to me. I know that. I know I love being behind this microphone and just the sheer amazement of all you who out there who let me talk to you through your speakers, whether it's a computer or cell phone or whatever, however you pick us up. And, lately I've really been down and out. I've been kind of depressed, frustrated, stressed with, everything going on, and a lot of that dealing with Mysteries Magazine. I just want to get it all back on track, and I want to get back to having fun and really enjoying this show like I have over the past few years. And recently it honestly just was becoming, it felt like a huge burden. And that has nothing to do with the listeners, but just the show itself and the time that it takes to put together the show and the magazine and everything else we have going on. Many may not realize, quite honestly, I do about 98% of what we have going on. And, I've had a lot of people reach out to me and say, hey, I'm willing to help and this and that. But the problem is we just don't have the money to pay people to help. And many people have offered to do it for free. But I really believe that if someone does some work, especially for a company, then they should get compensated for it. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why, you know, for those who have approached us, why I kind of say, you know, yeah, well, that time will come, because I hope that we do get this back on track. And that time will come where we can, you know, our listeners and our readers, we can bring them in as being a part of the magazine, of the show, and actually get compensated for it. You know, I would love it. We talk so much about community here, and that's what we want to see happen. Now, one other thing I want to really, really talk about is the 24-hour bash. We did have some things happen during the 24-hour bash that upset people, that offended people, and that was quite frankly not like Shadows in the Dark. As many of you know, we really mixed up this 24-hour bash with different hosts and guests and things that we were doing. And unfortunately, some of that bit us in the butt. And I want to apologize to anyone who was offended, who didn't like it. You know, and this is on air and off air. This took place on both sides. And I'm really going to briefly talk about it. I'm not going to mention names. I'm not even going to be specific about what happened. And then it's going to be time to move on. But I just want those who were offended, who were upset by it, to please, please understand that it is not anything Shadows in the Dark would do and would be a part of and would approve. These things were done outside of my knowledge. And I found out, you know, after the fact, to be honest, after the broadcast, that some of this did happen and that people were offended by it. You know, it really hurt me, because in 3 years of doing Shadows in the Dark, and this is no exaggeration, I really wish, you know, to be honest, I don't wish I was exaggerating, but it is not an exaggeration. In 3 years, we have never received one piece of hate mail, hate email or whatever, anybody contacting us saying they were upset or that they hated it. And quite honestly, some of these emails even said that they were no longer going to listen to the show and they were going to pass the word around to not listen to, quote, our Howard Stern show. As many of you know, in 3 years, I think Shadows in the Dark is far from being compared to Howard Stern. And, you know, to me, those were very, very hurtful remarks, because I would hope that those out there who know me, who have tuned into this show either since the beginning or even over the past few months, I just don't believe in that stuff. I believe in respect. I believe people should treat people with respect, and that's the bottom line. And we do here, and we have, and we will continue to do so. And I was very upset of the things that did take place and the things I found out took place. And again, that's just not us. And we're going to get this back on track, and we're going to get this show rolling like it has in the past. And I'm looking forward to it. I do miss being behind the microphone. I do miss seeing you guys, you know, on Sundays and Thursday nights. Of course, it's going to be Sunday nights only now, but I'll get to see you longer, right? I get to see you for 3 hours instead of two. But we're going to have a lot of fun with the show, and that's we're going to bring it back to that. We're going to have fun. We're going to share information, and we're going to get to, you know, we're going to continue to chisel away at the truth of life. And for me, that's what this show has a lot to do with, is trying to understand life, trying to understand why we just might be here. What is the purpose? Is there a purpose? What's the meaning? Why do some things happen? And, you know, again, that's what it is for me. It's getting out there and trying to understand who we are and what we are. And I want to continue that. I don't see myself doing anything else. And, you know, I do have the fear that if we don't get things like Mysteries Magazine and the show back on track, I don't know what I would do with my life. I really don't. Because all of this, you know, and to be honest with you, right now, all of this does stand a good chance of coming to an end. We are very much teetering on, you know, continuing our closing shop. And I don't want to see that happen. So I'm going to continue to figure it out. I'm going to continue to figure out how we can get this to continue, how we can publish the magazine, broadcast the show, and do all the other things we have talked about. One thing I will tell you I have learned is no more deadlines. We talk about we're going to do this, and we put a date on it, and it never happens. Well, from now on, we're just saying, hey, we're going to try to do this, and it's going to happen when it happens. You know, I wanted to launch our new website tonight, but unfortunately, there were some things that you know, came up that kept that from happening, and I tell you what, it looks really, really good. So, you know, hopefully we can get it out there the next show. I don't know, but I think you guys will really, really like it. We're not going to update this site until that one launches, in which this site will no longer exist. We will also have a new URL. We're really trying, in a way, I guess, wiping the slate clean and trying to start over and get this thing back to where it was. You know, 3 years, man, I've had a lot of fun over 3 years, and I want to have fun for 50, 60, 70 years, whatever. I guess if 70 years, I'd be over 100 years old. Why not? You know, I hope 70 years from now, I'm over 100, and I'm still behind this microphone. I think that would be a lot of fun. You may not be able to understand me. You know, I could, I'd have an old man's voice and all that, calling everybody youngsters and son and whatnot. So, but hey, it would be a lot of fun, wouldn't it? You know, I really do hope that this gets the opportunity to continue for many, many years. I have met nothing but great friends, doing this show. Other host of shows, listeners, writers, subscribers, the whole nine yards. I can't tell you how much I enjoy talking to each and every one of you and sharing opinions, thoughts, theories, you know, whatever the case may be. It's what I love, and I love doing this, and I want it to continue. You know, we do have to get over the financial part of it all. We've been very open with everyone about what's going on. And yes, we do have that financial hump to get over. I hate money. I think money is one of the worst things that could ever exist. But the fact of the matter is, it costs to print. It costs to broadcast. And somehow or another, we have to find that money and make it happen and get things back on track. So, you know, again, I do apologize for some of that stuff that people were offended about. I hope it doesn't hurt us in your eyes. I hope it doesn't hurt us with many out there. You know, I really hope it doesn't, because if you really know Shadows in the Dark, you know that wasn't us. So I do apologize. Well, we're going to be back in just a few minutes. We're going to be talking with Douglas Dietrich tonight. Yes, good old Douglas. He's been on the show many, many times. And, you know, always a fascinating story coming from Douglas. You know, it is one of those things, you know, you really have to try to figure out if it's, what you believe in and what he tells us. But it's going to be interesting. We're going to talk about Roswell tonight, and you'll be very fascinated what Douglas has to say about that. So back in a moment. Like I said, our guest tonight is Douglas Dietrich. You know, I feel maybe at this point, Douglas probably doesn't need an introduction to our show, as he's been a guest for quite some time. But, you know, he was a librarian for the Department of Defense out in California. And one of the things that Douglas has done is he was there to basically destroy, not to keep things hidden, but to destroy, to make room, declassified documents. And over that time, Douglas was able to shorthand some of the information that he has came across through those years, and has been kind enough to come and share some of that on the show with us. Now, you've heard him talk about vampires, you've heard him talk about zombies, and tonight we're going to talk about Roswell, the most famous UFO case in America, or even worldwide at that. And, you know, we're going to hear a very interesting side of exactly what may have happened out in Roswell in 1947. Douglas, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk, Mr. Greer, and I really appreciate, as always, the audience being there for us. And I think that maybe because everyone is so familiar with the Roswell incident, we should start with a short introduction with the Roswell environment and what exactly took place there before going into the details behind what happened. Does that sound about right to you, Mr. Greer?
Yeah, let's do that, because, you know, even though it's a very famous case, not everybody is familiar with it. Some, you know, you definitely run across a few like, huh, what are you talking about? But
right.
But, yeah.
Right. Well, I think that everybody, unfortunately, gets so fixated on Roswell as a microcosm, they forget that Roswell is part of a tremendous environment of New Mexico, which has this huge military involvement in terms of its economy. Indeed, it is the military that was a tremendous part of its economy, especially after the ceasefire of the Second World War. And so when the Roswell incident took place, which was actually on July 2nd, 1947, as opposed to the July 7th date, which sticks in everybody's mind because rancher Mac Brazel found the debris that he found on the field near his ranch on the 7th, the actual explosion that was heard by many people was on July 2nd. Mm-hmm. And this was barely a week after the Kenneth Arnold sightings, and it took place near Corona, New Mexico. And Socorro is just west, which you also have the Los Alamos nuclear facility 100 miles north, and the atom bomb and missile test facilities of White Sands and Alamogordo Holloman Air Force Base are only a short distance south. So this is obviously bracketed by an enormous amount of military activity. And in terms of New Mexico itself, it's the fifth largest state in the Union, but its population is less than a third of that of Los Angeles even today. And it's flatline stable, basically. It doesn't really grow or shrink. And back in 1947, in a sense, it was functionally unpopulated as far as the U.S. government was concerned in terms of civilians who might be threatened by nuclear experimentations or heavy explosive tests. But in terms of the outside of the Antarctic, there is a larger concentration of scientists in New Mexico than almost anywhere else. The largest population of scientists in the world is, of course, in the Antarctic.
Right.
But New Mexico runs a close second. And so you certainly have also, unfortunately, due to the extreme poverty of the many Indians who live on reservations in New Mexico, and certainly around 1945 to 47, during the final stages of the wind down from the war itself as an action-oriented war, the people in New Mexico who were Caucasian had also the lowest level of education in terms of normal U.S. statistics for educational levels. So you had a very uneducated populace, in both the Indian and the Caucasian population, a highly educated scientific elite, and the military that was basically dominating the New Mexico scene. So this is something that a lot of people don't bring into perspective as kind of the background of what happened, because the reason it's important to bring that out is because these people are not stupid people. They're not dumb. It is simply that they are not cosmopolitan. And
right.
The people who were growing up in that area, the television, and it, indeed, at the Mac Brazel Ranch, where the debris was found, he had absolutely no amenities that we would consider normal. He had no plumbing. He had no electricity. So he was living essentially a frontier existence. And so when what happened occurred, he had to drive into town with the debris that he found to deliver it to the sheriff, because he had heard that there was actually rewards that were given for debris that was picked up from military accidents. And that is exactly what he had brought in at that time. So in terms of everything so far, I think that people are very familiar with it. What people don't understand is that UFO crashes, quote-unquote, are really common in that whole desert region. And as an example, in 1953, there was a crash concerning an experiment with monkeys that were in a drone-piloted plane. And so it was that was basically something that locals found and brought in March 22nd of 1950. Before that, there were three disks about 50 feet in diameter that crashed 80 miles distance from Roswell. This was called the Aztec crash site. So there was a number of disk crashes and various drone plane crashes that were ongoing in the desert, and all told there was about 20 that were documented in local newspapers. So when I try to bring this up, I put the Roswell crash into perspective of a lot of different crashes. And by UFO, of course, it simply means unidentified flying object. Right. The one that seems most identifiable as something that is truly inexplicable would be, of course, the Socorro landing, which was written by, which was witnessed by the policeman, Mr. Zamora. And I'm sure many people are also familiar with that. Now, there is something in that that is truly inexplicable, and there's other things that I can bring up that, that kind of feed into this story. But in terms of what did crash at Roswell, what I try to explain to people is that this was an ongoing part of the wind down of World War II. And so between 1945, when the ceasefire was declared in the Pacific Theater, and 1951, when the peace was signed with Japan formally on the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco, Japan and America were still legally at war. And what happened at Roswell concerned Japanese prisoners of war, and it concerned the craft that they were trying to, by orders of the emperor, show the Americans how to fly, demonstrate how it was done, cooperate with the Americans until they had their first opportunity to commit suicide. And so I need to put that into some cultural perspective, and I need to put that into the perspective of the war, because a lot of people will not understand exactly what I'm talking about. But if you certainly have any questions, feel free to ask them. I do want to refer people to www.ufopilots.blogspot.com, and they can access images, sketches that I took of the Japanese craft that crashed at Roswell. And this was set up by Tor Olof Jobom, who is a Brazilian ufologist. He's a young guy whose grandfather actually was Swedish and settled in Brazil while he was hunting for UFOs that he thought were coming from inside of the Earth, intraterrestrials. And a lot of his exploration party actually was killed by aboriginals in the Amazonas. And he settled into Brazil after that. And you know, Tor Olof and the Brazilian community have been very helpful in setting up this website as fast as we could. There's a lot of images on there. The first three are sketches of the craft itself, the military gondola. I haven't had time to do any sketches of the dirigible that it was connected to as of yet.
Right.
These sketches were based on the photographs that I was dealing with in terms of the Roswell documents that I worked with. So that takes some explaining. Basically, what had happened was that around the 1980s, when I was a librarian's aide and having been promoted to a military reference technician, my operations manager brought in a whole load of just footlocker-sized, real, almost antiquated-looking steel boxes that he had had set up in one of the research rooms. And he brought me in to basically do the grunt work, because he wasn't about to collate all of these documents for the commandant of the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco. And when he told me to get to work on them, I thought it was a joke, because the category of top secret clearance that was required to work with them was something that I had never even seen before. They literally had a label on them that said, Crypto Cosmic top secret, and then stapled above that in various tags were the words that were just written in almost like with a magic marker above. So basically they said, crypto cosmic top secret above. And when I saw that, of course, not having security clearance that was anywhere near that level, I told them that I couldn't work with these at all. If I did so, I would be under threat of going to prison for tampering with such documents. And, of course, being the kind of corrupt and lazy individual that he was, this had happened many, many other times in the past, but never so vociferously. He basically at this point threatened me and said that, well, you know, Dietrich, if you don't get to work on those documents, I'm going to tell the MPs you tried to walk out with some of those documents under your arms off base, and you will spend the rest of your life in jail. Now get to work. So under protest, I did work with these documents, and it took, of course, literally about 5 to 6, ultimately 10 days to fully collate the documentation, during which time I was able to scrabble and take copious notes, which I always did with many of the documents that I worked with out of vindictiveness, if for no other reason. But during that period of time, I also was able to pilfer one of the more coherent pieces of debris that were in the boxes, because they were extremely poorly cataloged in terms of the debris that were in the boxes. They were literally stuck in there like junk. And I think the reason for that was because the choice pieces of debris that were useful for any kind of technology rip-off or reverse engineering were gone.
Right.
So
yeah.
So what I have is a coherent piece of debris from Roswell. It does have inscriptions on it that vaguely resemble some of what Jesse Marceau described. It is a metal. It's light as a feather. More than anything, I would be willing to bet that metallurgical and chemical analysis would simply present it as Japanese aluminum, right down to the rivet manufacturing that is within the piece of debris that I have, and that it probably originated in Japan around the 1940s and existed, you know, until the time of destruction. So the ink tests on the paint would be able to confirm that. So probably, and so I will definitely, as a matter of fact, I'm certain of it, just based on the history of which I am aware. So that brings us to the history of what exactly was happening.
Well, let me ask you one thing.
Sure.
In terms of the debris that was in the box, I mean, did they have it? I mean, anything to identify, say, well, this is what they thought it was, or, I mean, just more or less it was just kind of tossed in there?
Mm-hmm. Well, the debris was simply tossed into a box that was specifically for the debris. And there were several boxes that were kind of similar to that, in other words, like photos and various paraphernalia. But the debris box was, yes, it was just mostly junk. And like I said, I think the cavalier attitude that it was treated with was indicative of what I was reading in the documents, that at this point, whatever was worth taking was taken. But keep in mind, this was never under the kind of mindset where, oh my God, from the U.S. military's perspective, we have this fabulous alien technology and we've got so much to learn from it. This was already under the mindset of these were Japanese prisoners of war, and they knew what they were working with. So they knew what technology at that point could be taken. It was more a question of just rounding up debris and keeping it secure, and basically silencing any efforts to leak out the situation. And there are so many reasons behind that. I mean, one of the things that I need to emphasize is that the U.S. government has never offered any explanation for Roswell. Any. I'm not talking about the changes in story. The U.S. government has never said anything. The only branch of the U.S. government that has made statements concerning Roswell and monopolized the entire incident has been the United States Air Force. So the United States Air Force has repeatedly changed its story on the Roswell phenomena, you know, at least 3 times up to this point. First the weather balloon, then the crash test dummies, and then more formally the Mogul balloons, which were monitoring Soviet explosions, all of which is patently absurd, because in 1947 the Soviets had not yet blown up an atomic bomb. So that needs to be put into perspective, too. Working as long as I have with so to finalize my thought, though, on the U.S. Air Force,
right.
When people do say that, well, the U.S. Air Force represents the U.S. government, we have to remember that every branch of the military service has to answer constitutionally to the civilian government. And we are not ruled by the U.S. Air Force. We are ruled by the executive and the other branches of constitutional government.
Right.
So the fact that the United States Air Force, one single military service, has monopolized this is almost absurd. And there are very strong reasons for it. It's they themselves, the U.S. Air Force, that is extremely threatened, certainly in the early years, about any revelations of what was connected with Roswell or any such similar tests or disc crash, but specifically the Roswell incident. But in terms of what goes on with the in terms of the Soviets and what to put this into perspective, because everyone in hindsight now, especially the new generations of people who grew up with the Roswell myth, the TV series, its impact on popular culture, everyone is under the impression that when the Air Force is presenting its stories, it keeps presenting them from an angle of the Cold War. And it keeps presenting them from an angle of, for instance, oh, we're doing this because of tests from the Soviets, we're monitoring Soviet radiation levels from above-ground nuclear testing, their effects on the atmosphere. That's what the Mogul story is about. As a Department of Defense librarian, I had to deal in terms of referencing works for an enormous number of think tanks, from RAND slash MIT operations to any other private corporations that contracted themselves to the Department of Defense. So in working with these think tanks, I grew quite familiar with the war games that they were simulating in terms of all-out thermonuclear destruction, in terms of military exchanges. And they were presenting very early in the game the idea of MAD, or mutually assured destruction, the immense nuclear destruction that would result from an interchange between the Soviet Union and the United States. Well, working with their actual documents and records and all of the research that was coming in from reconnaissance and what the U.S. knew about the Soviet Union, I can tell you for a fact, and this is a fact, and it can be clarified, that in 1961, the Soviet Union only had 4 operational ICBMs. And so when we go back to its original blowing of an atomic bomb, its original explosive test, this was in 1949. And most specifically, it was in the month of August 1949. And so in 1947, when the Roswell incident took place, the Soviets had no nuclear capability of their own that they had produced. So that needs to be emphasized, and that the Cold War, as we understand it, as an atomic stalemate, had not yet even developed. So we have to go into the point again is, why would the Roswell records be at the Presidio Military Base then? Why would the Presidio Military Base Commandant be interested in them? You know, what would be the connection between the Presidio and Roswell? And that brings us back to the history of the Presidio, in terms that it's one of the oldest military bases in the United States. It was established in 1776 by conquistadors, but later overtaken by the U.S. government. It was essentially a place where it was the Area 51 of its time. If anyone were to visit the Presidio Military Base today, it is a national park. But Crissy Field, which is available and open to the public, is the spit of beach and sand where they used to test biplane float planes. This was back in the late 1890s to the early 1900s. So they were actually testing planes that could take off on the water from that spit of sand in the Presidio Military Base. So this was considered the most advanced aeronautical research area of its time. Later that was transferred inland, all of that technology, but the historical contacts remained. And one of the things that's very important is the fact that it was the Western Command Center for all of the U.S. Army in the western United States, west of the Rockies, as well as the Pacific commands out to Hawaii. So it was to assume massive logistical importance all the way up to the days of the Gulf War. So we're talking about a pivotal area. It was a political military base, because any commandant who was in charge of Presidio was automatically ensured access to political connections, because he was invited by the mayor as perfunctory requisite to all of the parties where he would meet the governor of California, visiting presidents, etc. So any general in charge of the base was ensured political connections that would guarantee him the best of careers. So everyone always vied to get that position. So whoever was in charge as commandant was basically a politician in uniform. So you had immense power circuiting there. the war essentially was anticipated there because and this is important to the story, in 1941, in November, before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. Army's Military Intelligence Service Language School opened at the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco. It included four Nisei instructors and 60 students, 58 of whom were Japanese Americans, who were involuntarily conscripted. They anticipated the war beginning there. The United Nations was established there during the war, specifically to basically oversee resistance movements in occupied in nations occupied by the Axis all over the world, from Yugoslavia to China, etc. So since the United Nations was established there, it had an international importance. It was later moved to New York, the UN, but the consulate records from the days it was established there were all still there. The peace treaty for Japan was signed there in 1951, and what happened in 1945 was a ceasefire. So all of this is relevant to why those documents were brought there, because they had to deal with the Japanese prisoners of war who were still legally prisoners from 1945 to 1951. So in terms of what was going on was a technology exchange program at that point, because like the Nazi rocketeers and the German scientists who were brought to the United States after the end of the war, who helped actually build the atomic bomb, because Germany had a ceasefire in 1945 before the Trinity explosion. And until the time of the Trinity explosion, the Americans were way behind in the atomic race. After the war in Germany and in Europe are ground to a stalemate and ceasefire, the German scientists were brought over. Many of them were brought to Los Alamos, where they helped complete the bomb project. That's why Robert Oppenheimer said the bombs were of German provenance, or provenance. And so when that was taking place, both of the bombs with rocketry, etc., even though the Americans had invented the rocket, the modern rocket, with Robert Goddard, the German scientists were brought in because they had perfected it. This was the same with vertical takeoff and landing technology with the Japanese. Basically, the Americans were exposed to brilliant advances in Japanese technology, where they were forced to acknowledge that at war's end, they were working with the Japanese in terms of helping them to find out how this technology could be used in ways that were advantageous to America. And it was in demonstration of this dirigible military gondola setup and its capability for lifting an American nuclear weapon that the accident at Roswell took place, or rather the suicide, because the Japanese, whenever they found the opportunity, would commit suicide. And people have any questions about that, I'll go into the culture of that mindset at, you know, later in the conversation. But every time they were in the air in these dirigibles, and there were several of them, there were at least three in the United States, the one that was over Roswell and others that had blown before, and they were all blown in the end. The Japanese would take their flare gun and they would just point it up at the dirigible, blow it into the dirigible, and immolate themselves, and their bodies would either incinerate and or scatter to the four winds. Most of the time they would scatter despite the intense heat and burning because they were wearing asbestos suits. And so that brings us to the whole point of what the gondolas were originally designed for. Mm-hmm. And who had designed them. So if you feel I'm not droning on too much, I'll get started on that immediately.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, these gondolas, the sketches off the website, I mean, they have a very unique look to them that you wouldn't picture something like that in the 40s. And, I did want to kind of ask your opinion on something. And, I mean, would you consider World War II, really there was a huge technology race behind the scenes that was going on? I mean, you hear of a lot of technology, especially from the Germans, that was one of their things that Hitler really wanted to do was advance German technology. I mean, to the point of just some amazing technology, stuff that even today we'd say, wow, there's just no way of doing that. And we're talking, 60 years ago.
Yeah, well, the German ultra technology is well acknowledged. And in a sense, it's easier for Americans to accept today because there is this element not of racism, but just of an expectation from Europeans that as a Western rationalist culture, that they should be able to develop these technologies. So when these technologies are exposed to Americans, it's not so much of a surprise. When I bring up what comes out of Asia, most Americans are just fall into a kind of denial. But we're talking about a kind of America was very technologically behind, and America's strength was like the strength of the Soviet Union. Raw resources and a bottomless sea of fuel, or so it seemed at the time, and it's the concept that quantity had a quality all its own. And in America, as opposed to Soviet manpower, it was mass production. So the Americans really excelled in mass production, and they themselves would call their Sherman tanks, they would call them Zippos, because one German rocket from the Panzerfaust would light them up like they were a candle. And they would refer to some of their planes as some kind of lighter joke in the same vein. I mean, Americans knew their products were not necessarily as good as that of the Germans, but they had a lot more of it. But to put an example of how far behind America was in technology, it all goes down to a simple reason. Most Americans are familiar with the nuclear aspect of the war, so I will start with that because it is important, and it's one of the things that brought the Japanese balloon bomb technology and later the dirigible gondola technology into play at Roswell. And that's the fact that Enrico Fermi, who was an Italian scientist who had come to the United States, was the President Roosevelt's science advisor. And when Einstein in the early 30s came up with E equals mc squared, every physicist in the world understood that E equals mc squared would release an enormous amount of energy if applied mechanically, had the potential to do that. So the physicists in the world were basically in Germany, Japan, Russia, America, and Britain. And in terms of Britain, it pursued the nuclear race very haphazardly, very eccentrically, very erratically, and ultimately surrendered all responsibility to the Americans when they found out the Americans were conducting nuclear pursuits. But the Americans weren't conducting nuclear pursuits because that wasn't until later in the war, because Enrico Fermi had told Roosevelt that it would take 100 years before a bomb could be manufactured that would release the energy that was conceptualized by E equals MC squared. So Roosevelt just thought it couldn't be done. It would take 50 years to materialize any extraction of energy, 100 years to make a bomb. He honestly believed that. So did Enrico Fermi. He was incredibly conservative and in that regard. And what happened was Einstein, when he immigrated from the Third Reich, had to beg Roosevelt through an enormous amount of letters, and ultimately he got together a kind of scientist group that advocated for the development of the bomb, and it was only through this kind of lobbying aggressively that late in the war, literally 1942, around the time of the Battle of Midway, Roosevelt grudgingly starts off this project of the Manhattan Project, the nuclear bomb, and they were way behind because in the 1930s, literally in 1938, Japan had purchased a cyclotron clone from UC Berkeley. They had one cyclotron in Japan that was a clone of what existed at UC Berkeley, and they ultimately developed five based on that design. So there were over five cyclotrons in Japan alone. And in terms of the Germans, they had even more. So the Russians, because of the purges of their scientists, the direction they were going in science, they weren't pursuing atomics at all. So Stalin pretty much put Russia, as we've seen earlier in the conversation, way behind in the race, and they just waited until the Americans built the bomb because they knew that many communist sympathizers like Oppenheimer would ultimately just give them the secrets, which is what Oppenheimer ultimately did and paid for that with his career because he was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. Mm. But in terms of the Americans, because they were so far behind, that is one of the reasons why it took the German ceasefire. German scientists came over. They helped them finish the bomb. But to go on to what happened with Japan, they were developing biological warfare. And it needs to be put into perspective that we're talking about scientists. We're talking about science power. The only nation on Earth in history that was ruled by a scientist was Japan. And that was ruled by Emperor Hirohito, who was a marine biologist. And the point that people don't remember is that until the time of Sir Isaac Newton, there was no such thing as formalized science. Even Sir Isaac Newton himself dabbled in alchemy. He was always trying to turn lead into gold, and Sir Isaac Newton ultimately had a period where he had a mental breakdown due to lead poisoning and various other poisonings from various chemicals he was working with, and it took years of rehabilitation at a hospital before he was set loose in the public again. So Sir Isaac Newton was one of the first scientists, and then after that, formal scientist is recognized today. And after that, there were some other scientists that were developed in academies that were more formally recognized. And so what we gradually got was the fact that by World War II, 98% of all scientists that had ever lived were alive in World War II. But a scientist by himself is a very impotent individual. He's totally dependent on funding. If no one gives the scientist funding, he can't produce.
Right.
And so here you had a situation where Emperor Hirohito, who was basically regarded by the Japanese as God incarnate, became a scientist. So we have a situation in which the biologist is literally considered God. So he had everything that he wanted. So there was nothing he was lacking in terms of what he could do in terms of scientific projects. So he experimented vociferously. He ordered the creation of human experimentation in China and Manchuria, and ultimately was able to create extremely effective biological weapons. And it was these weapons that he threatened the United States with that forced a ceasefire at the end of the war. And that's what brings us to this kind of fulcrum of what exactly was going on. In terms of the balloon bombing campaigns that were ultimately going to carry biological weapons to the United States, the Americans were originally hiding everything that Emperor Hirohito was throwing against them. There was an order for silence, and that pervaded all the way up until, you know, the Roswell incident, because to put this into perspective again, there was no such thing as a U.S. Air Force. There was only the United States Army Air Corps, and there was Naval Aviation. So because there was no U.S. Air Force, the United States really did not have effective air defense. So their air forces were basically, they were aggressive in nature and meant for overseas projection, power projection, but they did not have an air force for defense of the country. One of the maps that I've got up on that blog spot is U.S. Air Force control, and it's underneath the heading of topological space collapse. And you see this map that has this star in the center of Air Force Command, and all of these defense projections basically come out from it, including the island of Cuba, which at that point the Americans occupied. That map was drawn in 1942 at the height of the Battle of Midway. And that map was drawn by Air Marshal Dzerzhinsky. And Dzerzhinsky was a Tsarist Russian immigre who said the United States needs an air force for home defense because these carrier battles prove that the carrier power projection just concentrates all your planes on a floating flat top. Once it sinks, you lose an enormous part of your air power. You have to have all your strategic air power at home and project it from there. And so that map in 1942 highly influenced many senior U.S. Army officers who said he's absolutely right. Our air power is non-existent in terms of home defense, and they were proven radically right when the balloon bombing campaigns begun. The Americans had never discovered, because they didn't have a scientist ruling their country who was directing the operations, they had never discovered the jet stream. The Americans did not know about this during the war until they started bombing Japan. And what happened was when they had the super bombers, the B-29s, flying over 30,000 feet, they found that the jet stream was so powerful that these bombers were slowed down immensely, and they had to start low-level bombing, which made them extremely vulnerable to anti-aircraft fire. And so many of them were being damaged that the air crews were being killed at such a high rate that they had to have the Battle of Iwo Jima just so they could have a spot for these damaged B-29s to land, so that they could save the air crews. And that's what the Battle of Iwo Jima was all about. That's how damaging this was. The Japanese, however, because they were ruled by a scientist, had known about the jet stream. Emperor Hirohito had ordered meteorological surveys, which discovered that at 30,000 feet, the jet stream could carry a balloon, and it only went one way, from Japan to the United States. It could carry a balloon across the Pacific in 3 to 4 days.
Huh.
And so he ordered the construction of a balloon bombing campaign, and the balloon bombs were paper balloons from the Japanese Army, rubberized silk balloons from the Japanese Navy. And the Japanese Navy and Army were totally separate branches. They never had any connection with each other. But basically, to kind of explain how damaging these balloon bombs were, in March 10th of 1945, 4 months before Trinity, one of these balloon bombs collided with an array of high-tension power lines at the site of the Bonneville Dam in Washington State. power was lost over that entire state area, at least half of it, including the Manhattan Project's Hanford Works, which was all involved in the generation of plutonium for the project's headquarters in Los Alamos. So for 3 days, Hanford was forced to suspend work on the atomic bomb. The reason this particular incident, many incidents like this happened throughout the war that cut off power to Los Alamos, but the reason this incident stands out is because that's when Truman was sworn in as president. So the first thing that happened when President Truman was sworn in after the death of Roosevelt, the first thing he was told was, all the power's out in the atomic bomb production facility. And the first thing he said was, what's an atomic bomb? He had no idea what an atomic bomb was. It was something that was a fixture in popular culture and science fiction for many years, but he had never been a science fiction fan.
Right.
And the point about what was going on was that when he did find out about what was going on, he found out that he was facing a nightmare. You see, this is what the Americans need to understand, is that until around shortly before World War I, all of the land that was west of the Mississippi River was officially frontier land. And it wasn't recognized as part of the United States. It was territorial. It became incorporated as United States administrative states shortly before World War I. Vast tracts of the states in there, especially Utah. And places like California were considered states. They were legally represented, but there was this dead zone in between California and the Mississippi. That's why St. Louis is called the Gateway to the West, that was considered frontier territory. Now, after World War I, all of these states were established as U.S. states, such as the Dakotas, etc. But what most Americans don't realize is that to this day, over 48% of the land west of the Mississippi is federal land. It's Indian reservations, it's military bases, it's missile testing ranges, it's national parks. And unless you're prospecting or poaching in the wrong place at the wrong time, you're not going to see anything the government doesn't want you to see. And you can say, oh, but what about these national parks? There's these roads. Well, there's vast tracts in Nevada that are still closed to the American public because they're radioactive hell zones where they've tested so many bombs that if you enter, you are literally sentenced to death because the radiation is still so strong. Ultimately, John Wayne and some of the people who worked with him in the film The Conqueror were exposed to so much radiation from filming in some ghost towns that were close to these bomb test sites that they died of radiation cancer. And so that's one of the things that, you know, few people recognize about how empty and arid and basically separated from the American public so many ranges of that land are. And what they don't want you to know, you're not going to find out. One of the things they didn't want people to know was that in maybe about 6 months between November 1944 and about June of 1945, about 10,000 balloons were launched that set that the Northwest Pacific Forest on fire. And these firestorms were so immense that the Americans conscripted all kinds of blacks to form the triple nickels or the 555 to act as expendable smoke jumpers. And these blacks were ordered to jump into the middle of these firestorms and do what they could to put out the fires. And so many hundreds of them died that none of them were ever given military benefits, military medals, or military recognition because they were part of the Civilian Conservation Corps. And they were considered civilians. And therefore, everything they did was secretly covered up and there was no compensation. So they had white smoke jumpers that were part of what was called the Civilian Public Service. And these numbered only in the hundreds, maybe about 50,000. And these were conscientious objectors, like Mennonites, who refused to answer the draft. They were given a choice between jail or highly dangerous work as smoke jumpers for surgical insertion near the outskirts of these firestorms. And they served throughout the war to put these firestorms out. Now, people have heard about certain families being killed, and that's where the news leaked, because one of them, for instance, was a priest. I believe he was a preacher. I'm trying to remember his name now, but he can ultimately be looked up when you look up balloon bomb attacks. And that was at Oregon, I believe, and his whole family was wiped out, about his wife and five children. And when the U.S. government approached him with threat of death, if he's talked, of course, he didn't care about talking anymore because he had already lost everything. Yeah, his name now is Archie Mitchell. I do remember that. They named the Mitchell Recreation Area after him at Klamath Falls Tree Farm in Oregon. But in terms of what had happened with them, many families suffered smaller losses or injuries. And they were ordered by the U.S. government to shut up because this was a national security issue. So nobody knew what was going on, but everybody knew that in 1945, suddenly it all stopped. And the American government said, well, if they continued on to the summer of 45, they would have burned everything to the ground. Why didn't they continue? Well, at that point, Emperor Hirohito had found out what he had wanted to know, because 10% of the balloons carried radio signal mechanisms that were that enabled the Japanese, by observing the forest fire smokes, by observing the radio signals, they were able to totally map out the wind pattern that came over the United States annually on a regular basis, and that was what they were going to use to guide these dirigibles that would carry the biological weapons. So that's an important thing that most people don't realize, and the Americans certainly realized at that point that they had no real defense for the air. You can see some desperate actions in terms of the what's on the blog spot, if people have access to that. Once again, that's UFOpilots.blogspot.com. In terms of the some of the balloons that were being pursued, I guess that's in a Hanford map that you can find. Let me see, it's somewhere in there. It's on the topological space collapse. There's the Air Force control map, the evacuation zone, the meteorological duds, the Zuni reservation, and then the Hanford Works. You can see a balloon that's being shot down by a what the Japanese call the four-tailed devil, or the Mustang. Or I probably got the American name wrong, and I do apologize for that. Yeah, but in terms of the plane shooting down that balloon, you can see how much it looks like a UFO and how that adds to some of the confusion regarding what took place in terms of a battle that was raging over America's airspace and which America was losing. The meteorological duds map, which shows all of those spots in that topological space collapse section, you see just literally hundreds of dots. And it's a Japanese map written after the war where they're referring to meteorological observations, and the officer who has drawn up that map is referring to the fact that these are duds that the Americans recovered. And that shows you, if those are the ones that didn't work out of the thousands that were launched, you can imagine how many did work and that were able to transmit information. Now, in terms of the observation of the smoke from the forest fires, how were the Japanese able to pull that off? Well, they were able to pull that off quite easily, as a matter of fact, by, if you look up in Collateral Technologies, that section in on the blog spot, there is a map of a Japanese boat that actually sailed all the way to Japan, from Japan to the United States, and it was this tiny little boat with six Japanese men on it with nothing but sails and oars, and they were able to make it all the way over the Alaskan Aleutian Islands of Alaska, all the way to the West Coast, and this was done in the 80s, and the Japanese were just proving that it was so easy for them to reach the United States in a matter of days using the right currents and using primitive technology. And what it goes to prove is that the Japanese submarines had just as easy a route to the United States. And during the war, the Japanese submarines were often launching planes from catapults that were built into the submarines that would make observations of the U.S. coast. And you can see that basically under the section, Japan Goes Nuclear. And by the way, some of these sections are puzzlingly titled, and I'll have to explain that later, but you'll see the Japanese submarines that are in the section of Japan Goes Nuclear on that blog spot are the giant I-400 class submarines, the smaller I-10 submarines. These were underwater aircraft carriers. They would carry planes that were inside of tubes that would be catapult-launched over America to make observations of the fires that were burning that were caused by the balloon bombs and report back so that the wind currents could be properly mapped by the Department of Meteorology back in Japan. And the reason that's so important is that they were later on a strategic nuclear threat to the United States that was used to bring a ceasefire at the end of the war. But in terms of the balloon bombs themselves, which were at Roswell, what had happened was these were biological delivery mechanisms. And so when Emperor Hirohito in 1945 ordered a number of these dirigibles to take off and land in the United States, they were able to prove, and if you take a look at these sketches of the military gondola under the dirigible, as I said, I haven't had a chance to draw out the dirigible yet, but the dirigible that was used to carry the military gondola was like a giant helium balloon on its side. It was a big disc-shaped dirigible, which is one of the reasons why Americans called them discs.
Right.
It was filled with hydrogen because America had a total monopoly on helium. The reason I put a picture of the Hindenburg up is because its explosion, or rather its burning, was so similar to the Hindenburg explosion. And if you take a look at Asians as Aliens, that section, when you take a look at the Hindenburg, if you really focus in on the superstructure of the Hindenburg, you'll see a man hanging on to the girders of the blimp itself, the balloon area. Now, how on earth did a man get up there into the balloon area itself? It's because the vortex of the flames sucked him up into the balloon section itself, as opposed to being on the gondola. It's exactly what happened to some of the Japanese crew members when they blew their own dirigibles. And again, to emphasize that the Japanese crews were the shortest of the short who were on these military gondolas because they were trying to conserve weight to carry as many bacterial bombs as possible.
Right. Now, let me stop you right there for a second, Douglas, before we get into that, because I had my time wrong in my head. Of course, I still thought we were broadcasting at 9:30 in my head, but of course we were. It was 9 o'clock, so we're about time to take a little bit of a break.
Sure.
And give for anybody who has just joined our chat room, give that website one more time. I've put it in the chat room a few times. I'll put it in there again where they can kind of see some of the stuff that you're talking about in terms of these gondolas and things. And I even found a website that had a lot of information about the Japanese balloon bombs and put that out there too.
Yeah, that's fine. And that's www.ufopilots.blogspot.com. And I'll certainly wait until we enter the break and we'll cover it after that.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll get into about the size of these Japanese pilots and things, because it does play.
And the gondola.
And the gondola. Yeah. So we'll definitely get into that.
Yeah.
So all you tuning in, we're going to take a quick break. Well, it's about 10, 11 minutes, right around in there. Since we're now a three-hour show, we'll have just a tidbit longer breaks to kind of let us breathe and get a sip of drink, but that's how it goes. But we'll be back in a minute with our guest tonight, Douglas Dietrich. Well, tonight our guest is Douglas Dietrich, and over the last hour we've been talking about some of the things that possibly led up to the Roswell incident in terms of Japanese balloon bombs and a lot of World War II history, and which I think is great. I mean, World War II, I mean, this was really one of the wars that sticks in most anybody's mind that you probably hear the most about. And I fully believe that not all that happened during that era has ever there's still a lot of information to be released. And Douglas, I'll be honest with you, I really, before talking to you, the Japanese balloon bombs, I never heard of it. It's out there. This isn't something that you've kind of pulled together. It's really out there. There are books on it, the whole nine yards, and I just thought this was really fascinating.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, and the Fugo, or balloon bombs, unfortunately, many of the sources that you will find are publicly available. It's great that they're out there because it demonstrates the inevitable leak of secrecy, which is ultimately important for maintenance of democracy. But at the same time, so much that's out there decries the effect that they had. And there is an agenda behind that, and the agenda behind that is to keep the American population from worrying. Like, my God, we were that close to losing the war.
Right.
I mean, losing it, totally losing it, in 1945. And that brings us back to the gondolas themselves. The military gondolas are very intriguingly shaped from the top view. It looks like a moth, and this configuration was actually an inspiration for some of the people who worked on the project under Hirohito's guidance to later on make films that showed Mothra as the protector of Japan. That is one of those little bits of trivia that never makes outside of Japan. But in terms of the bottom view, it looks more like a manta ray or a king ray with that definite stingray appearance, right, with its stabilizer and its trellis tail fin. Now, in terms of the bacterial bombs that the bottom view is shown dropping, the those bacterial bombs are actually what the Japanese referred to as parachute retarded. And the reason that they would have parachutes to retard their descent is because biological weapons, even though they're much more toxic than chemical weapons, are notoriously fragile because the bacteria will die when there's too much heat or when exposed to too much heat, such as friction from too fast a drop.
Right, yeah.
So the bombs are designed, and you can see an outline of one of the bombs in and when you take a look at, let me see, there is one of the bombs that is shown on, let me see, and you can help me with this probably, I'm looking for it now, in terms of next to General Ishihiro, who worked at Unit 731 to design the bomb itself. And but at any rate, there is an outline on that blogspot of how the bombs look in on the interior. And yes, they are ceasefire conditions underneath the heading of it's the first photo of General Ishihiro. And he was under direct command from Emperor Hirohito, and he designed bombs that are actually larger than the crew members who are piloting the gondola. The bomb itself is over 5 feet tall, and the crew members were all under 5 feet. So the bomb that you see outlined there, and you'll notice that the diagram is a document that is taken from Fort Detrick in the United States for the analysis of balloon bombs that were developed by General Ishihiro. And General Ishihiro is one of the most important men in history that you've never heard of, because he was responsible for the immense talkdowns that took place between Japan and the United States that ultimately opened up American markets to Japan. And in terms of to put that into perspective, Americans entered into negotiations with the Vietnamese throughout the Vietnam War through the Paris peace talks. They entered into negotiations with the North Koreans after the Korean War that have never stopped. We are still legally at war with Korea. People still meet at Panmunjom to this day who are American and North Korean to discuss terms concerning their nuclear experiments, etc. So the Japanese basically pioneered that by this five-year discussion and talk-down period of history that they were holding with the Americans. And General Ishihiro was one of the men who did that through the threat of his bacteria bombs. And so he proved that the best time to release bacteria bombs from dispersal delivery mechanisms such as that gondola were early in the morning when it was not yet hot enough to burn the bacteria inside of the bomb. So these were all coordinated early morning attacks if they were ever to be launched. So what happens is the design of the gondola itself is biomorphic because Hirohito was a marine biologist, and it was extremely radical enough where the Americans literally referred to it as alien. As a matter of fact, alien was a very common term applied to any Asians. I live in San Francisco, and California's Constitution, which was written in 1879 and is still in force, literally has a clause that says burdens and evils arising from the presence of aliens who are or may become vagrants, paupers, mendicants, criminals, or invalids, afflicted with contagious or infectious diseases, and from aliens otherwise contagious or dangerous or detrimental to the well-being or peace of the state, should have action taken against them as recommended by the legislature. This, at the time that the Constitution was written, was referring to Chinese. And at the time of the ceasefire conditions in the Pacific, all Asians, such as my mother — I was born in Taiwan, my father married a woman who was half Japanese, half Chinese, who was born in Tokyo but stationed in Taiwan at the end of the Pacific War — when my father married her, she was still legally registered as an enemy alien. And as a matter of fact, this term is used in the film Sayonara, starring Marlon Brando, which was basically explaining the problems that American troops had who fell in love with Asians in overseas when they were stationed in Japan. And that whole movie talks about a class action lawsuit, which my father was a part of, in which thousands of American GIs sued the U.S. government, sued the U.S. military, actually, who wouldn't allow them to marry Asian Pacific Islanders because they were all legally registered as enemy aliens. The Supreme Court overturned the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, as unconstitutional and said a man can marry whoever he wants. So my father was able to marry my mother in 1951 when peace was declared between Japan and the United States, and they took away the title of enemy alien. But all of the crewmen who were in the United States who were flying those gondolas were registered on all of the documents as enemy alien, enemy alien. So that term enemy alien just appears repeatedly in terms of any documents dealing with these Japanese prisoners of war.
Right.
So the gondola itself had a 270-foot wingspan. It had a design payload that could have handled enough fuel to fly nonstop all the way from Tokyo to the United States. But they discarded all fuel or a majority of it in the plane so that they could handle more bacterial bombs. If it was fully fueled, it could have a 16,000-pound bomb payload.
Jeez.
But when they took the fuel away to a bare minimum, then it could carry 26,000 pounds worth of biological weapons. So it had a design range of 10,500 nautical miles. But the people that were flying it would shave their heads and shave their eyebrows because of the threat of static electricity, because one of the theories behind the Hindenburg explosion was a static charge due to its mooring line, which was all the way down to the ground, and a static charge ran up the rope and set the Hindenburg aflame because of its nylon silver paint, which was highly flammable with its mirrored glossy pigment. Now, even when you rub your feet and your hands together on a doormat and you touch the doorknob and you get that little spark of electricity, that's 30,000 volts. But it goes through your body so quickly that it doesn't hurt you or kill you. But up in the jet stream, where you have a highly ionized atmosphere and lightning can strike at any time, as much static electricity as can be eliminated will have to be eliminated. So the crew members all shaved their heads, they shaved their eyebrows, they even shaved their crotch hair. And they were definitely dressed up in asbestos suits so that it could stay alive as long as possible to keep the plane working if the dirigible did explode. And the Emperor Hirohito launched three of these dirigibles towards the United States right after, I think it was, as a matter of fact, at the same time that the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that needs to be put into perspective, because the Americans never viewed the atomic bombs as anything important. General Curtis LeMay himself, when the atomic bombs were dropped, considered them so useless that he ordered more firebombings on the same day. And to put that into perspective here, on March 9th to 10th, about 334 B-29s dropped 2,000 tons of firebombs on Japan on the same day that the atomic bomb Hanford plants were shut down by the Japanese balloon bomb. When Truman was sworn in, that power was still out. On May 8th, Germany had a ceasefire. German scientists came to the Los Alamos test site, helped to complete the bomb. July 16th, you had the Trinity test. And then basically on the August 6th, which is the 7th in Asia, because they're one day ahead of us, Little Boy was dropped on Hiroshima. Now, there you'll see that this is important, the timing. You'll see in terms of, if you're able to look on the blog space, the bombs that failed. Underneath the bombs that failed category, it shows the bomb radius of the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, the bombs dropped on Hiroshima were basically a dud. What happened was, in the flight to Tinian Island, where they were to be taken to bomb Japan, the mechanism of the bomb itself was compromised, and as soon as they unloaded it from the plane, a physicist was exposed to so much radiation from a neutron surge that he died immediately. And they had to try and fix the bomb by sticking all kinds of polonium inside of it, these little polonium rods. And this is a very strange element that had nothing to do normally with making an atom bomb work, but it was like sticking nitrous oxide into a race car engine to make it go faster, a kind of cheating, if you will. So the physicist who did that was Dr. Luis Alvarez, and Dr. Luis Alvarez basically stuck the entire world supply that was accessible to the United States of polonium into that bomb just so that it would work. And when it did go off, it was a dud in the sense that it had a 2-kilometer range. And right. So that was considered a 2-kilometer radius, a 2-kilometer radius in terms of destruction. The next bomb, Nagasaki, which was a plutonium bomb, actually worked much better and had about an 8-mile radius, and that was the working bomb, but nobody hears about it. It's called the forgotten bomb, and the reason why was because it was a total military failure. There were 2,500 workers in the Mitsubishi plane production plants that were in atomic bomb shelters below Nagasaki that never knew a bomb had been dropped. And they were producing what were called PATSYs, which were long-range bombers that would strike the United States. And the PATSYs can be spotted on the UFOpilotsblogspot.com. When you look up ceasefire conditions, there you can see the prototype Ki-77 and the PATSY. I wrote down some notes about the PATSY and its range and how the Japanese used it as strategic deterrence against the Soviets. And the point is, these planes were being built underground in the Mitsubishi factories, totally untouched and unscathed, not even by radiation, by the Nagasaki bomb above. So the Japanese not only took the punch, they had the ability to strike back at that point with full force, and the bombs were totally meaningless. They had nothing to do with the ceasefire terms at that time. That's something that so many Americans do not realize. As a matter of fact, there are several people, including a Japanese field marshal who presented the emperor with the fact that Japan could survive atomic war with the United States, who survived both bombs, specifically Kenshi Harada, Misako Katani, Tsutomu Yamaguchi. These were three people that the Japanese recognized as two bomb survivors. So they do not have this total destructive capability that everyone fantasizes. And so at the time the bombs had been dropped, it was very shortly after that, on August 7th, the day after the Hiroshima bomb, that Hirohito launched the gondolas. The gondolas reached the United States on August 11th, loaded with bacterial bombs, and the crews were ordered to turn themselves in so they could present the Americans with an ultimatum. And they presented the Americans with the ultimatum that these will come in droves, and we can destroy the entire population of the west coast of the United States with these bacterial bombs, and they have no range, because whoever meets anybody who's infected will in turn be infected. Whoever treats anybody who's infected will in turn be infected. Right. And they've made the atomic bomb obsolete at that time. Then suddenly, on that very day, General George Marshall ordered General Groves of the atomic bomb project at Los Alamos, and this is historically viable, he ordered him, do not ship any more fissionable material to the Pacific. And he ordered an immediate aerial ceasefire concerning Japan. Huh. And on that day, the same note delivered by these pilots told the Americans to watch and observe Konan, Korea, for an atomic bomb test. And that atomic bomb test took place in Konan, Korea. And if you take a look at the map on in terms of one of the maps there, I have a map that basically shows the Japan specifically, and it's on ceasefire conditions. It's right next to underneath the PATSY bombers. If you take a look on ceasefire conditions, there's a prototype for the PATSY bomber itself. Then it shows Birobidzhan, which is this Jewish community that was set up by the Japanese, where they got a lot of physicists to help them design the bombs. And the reason for that was that Adolf Hitler wanted to get rid of Jews in Germany. So early in the 1940s, the Japanese set up a community for them above Manchuria. It's that little red nation still exists today. The national language is Yiddish. It's incorporated as an autonomous region of the Soviet Union. They even have a tourist board. And what happened was that the Japanese resettled 1 million Jews into that area that were highly educated, technicians, engineers, who left the Third Reich. Many of them were physicists. They helped the Japanese to design an atomic bomb, which was built at Konan, Korea. And they basically, to describe how important that site was, the Yalu River, which is right below Birobidzhan, meaning that below China, Manchuria, the Manchurian region, it divides Korea from China. That river that divides Korea from China there's a city underneath it that says Kimchak. Right next to that was the atomic bomb building factory for Japan. This was a huge complex where they had dammed two rivers, and the two rivers provided so much electrical power that they delivered more than 1 million kilowatts of power to the complex. Just to put this into perspective, Japan itself produced no more than 3 million kilowatts of power. So those plants themselves had one-third of all of the power that was needed to service the nation of Japan. And with all of that, they were able, thanks to uranium delivered by German U-boats, they were able to build a number of bombs. They tested them on the 12th, August 12th at dawn. They blew an atomic bomb and destroyed a test fleet of little Chinese junks, old Korean ships, but the Americans were able to observe it aerially. And this was actually printed in the Atlanta Constitution in 1946. The author was David Snell, and so that was publicly reported, but nobody remembers it today, even though if you look back to the Atlanta Constitution, the summer of 1946, look up David Snell's article, you'll find an article on the Japanese atomic bomb test in August 12, 1945. And that was to show the Americans the Japanese had the bomb. And at that point, combined with that, the Americans offered ceasefire conditions until that time. And this has to be presented in terms of what was going on. The American public was just screaming for Emperor Hirohito's head. They were just basically, the American public was asked in polls in July and August of that year about how many wanted him dead. And the American public was, roughly one-third of the Americans wanted his immediate execution, one-fifth wanted imprisonment or exile, and one-sixth wanted a trial. But most of them wanted to kill him without even a trial. Suddenly, on August 12th, the Americans come up, 11th, excuse me, they come up basically by Behrens, who was the State Department head at that time, or the Assistant Chief of State. He basically sent a message to Japan saying that the freely expressed will of the Japanese people is what's important to us. So that is something that never goes into American history books. And again, because this cannot be overemphasized, the in terms of how little the Americans thought of the bomb, General Curtis LeMay himself said, it's nothing new about death. Nothing new about death caused militarily. We scorched and boiled and baked to death more people in Tokyo on one night on March 9th to 10th in 1945 than went up in vapor at Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. And Norman Ramsey, the physicist in charge of assembling both atomic bombs, he explained later that every week or so, 20,000 tons of explosives were being dropped on Japan in the course of normal bombing, and particularly the extrapolation as to what rate would be, and in fact was around July and August, was getting up to a magnitude which would be about or the same size in a few days as an atomic bomb. So from that point of view, of a good many people there in Japan, the atomic bomb was not considered to be nearly as potent a weapon. So in terms of why the bomb was so far behind schedule, too, your tax dollars at work, you had jerks like Dr. Lewis Slotin, who ultimately killed himself by playing baseball with half an A-bomb. This was before the Germans showed up. A visiting doctor by the name of David Bradley actually wrote in his diary that when he showed up at Los Alamos, he was tossed what he thought was a tennis ball, but when he caught it, it felt like a bowling ball, and he was informed, that's the A-bomb we're working on. And Slotin used to, you know, basically entertain himself by pushing two pieces of the plutonium together just so he could hear a Geiger counter click. And one of those days he died, and that was when the air around him was ionized blue. That's called Cherenkov blue. That's a shade of blue you never want to see. And his body disintegrated. Jeez. And so this is your tax dollars at work. When the Germans finally showed up, then the bomb was completed.
Right. Now, Douglas, I have a question from the chat room, and I want to grab it before it scrolls out.
Yeah.
Chat room's moving pretty fast here, and it might be a little step back to something we were talking about. In terms of the long-range Japanese aircraft, that's what this question is in terms of. It says, were any of these prototype long-range Japanese aircraft ever put into service and deployed in action against the Allied forces?
Now, are they talking about the gondolas or the Patsies?
I think probably, yeah, not the gondolas.
The Patsies were held. They didn't need to be deployed because if you see my notes that are on that, and this is for the people who cannot access that blog site, who are traditional radio listeners, for instance, The Patsies didn't need to be deployed because by the time they were fielded, the ceasefire was called. And the Patsies, as you can see in my notes there, were to be used to destroy all of the American bases, such as Qinyan, where the two atomic bombs had originated from, in theater. They were to be used in Japanese regions where they could take out the American infrastructure of bombing totally, so the Americans couldn't bomb Japan anymore. And the Patsies were also, as you can see, originally designed to fly nonstop from Tokyo to New York. And what happened was the range was immense. And Americans, of course, were never told about them because it was so embarrassing to the U.S. military infrastructure. That's why the Air Force acted like the mafia at Roswell, because if people were to find out, geez, the Japanese were bombing us this whole time, the American forces were totally unable to defend us from the air, we experienced what the Army Air Corps called topological space collapse. Think of what was going on at that moment in 1947. At that moment in 1947, there was still no such thing as a U.S. Air Force. The U.S. Army wanted desperately to get that so Curtis LeMay and his cronies could get billions of dollars in funding for a brand new service that had not existed before, and one that would net them billions of dollars in terms of equipment and provide a welfare state for physicists who would build all kinds of atomic bombs that, in effect, would never be used. And this guy would stood to lose all of that if the public found out that they had experienced in World War II topological space collapse, a total inability to defend their own airspace. So basically they separated children from the parents, parents from the children, told each of these parties, if you talk, they told the parents, we'll kill your children. They told the children, if you talk, we'll kill your parents. And the reason behind this is follow the money. There was an enormous amount of money to be gained and an enormous amount to be lost in terms of prestige and money, because if the public found out about it, the taxpayers would say, well, not only are we not putting out any money for this crap, we're not going to keep you guys employed. You people should be brought out and court-martialed. You people are totally incompetent. And the whole thing about this was basically a scam on us from the beginning, and you failed militarily in so many regards. So this is why, when I was working with these collated documents, the commandant of the Presidio Military Base, in exchange with the guy at Area 51, they're going over all this stuff because these are former Army. One of them's still Army. The other guy's now Air Force. But remember, there was all of the Air Force. It butted off from the Army. It was a separate service that came out of the Army. Mm-hmm. The only way that could have happened was by the scam they pushed on the public by destroyed Japan by air power. We used air power to totally make a nation surrender. And since that time, they've dropped more bombs on, just for instance, Laos alone during the Vietnam War than on Germany and Japan combined. And obviously, that amount of bombs did nothing to stop the supplies to South Vietnam of the Viet Cong guerrillas going through Laos from North Vietnam. Obviously, the air power scam has failed completely. It didn't work in Korea. It didn't work in Vietnam. And if anyone tells you otherwise, you can always say, well, if an atomic bomb drives a nation to surrender, drop one on Afghanistan and we can win the war.
Right. Good point.
And but in terms of what was going on with President Truman, because he launched into the ceasefire, he became the most hated president in U.S. history. He had one of the most stressful presidencies on earth. Roosevelt was a madman who had never wanted to talk surrender or negotiate with the Germans or Japanese. He was so insane that even when he was desperately sick, the very day of his nomination for his last few days as president, he was nominated for a fourth term, which is now illegal. And on the very day of his nomination, his son had to hold his head up and his shoulders up because he collapsed during his nomination. The whole event was hushed up. Truman had only met Roosevelt twice, and only both times for photo ops. And so when Truman became president, basically he had to negotiate this ceasefire based on his military experience. He was the last American president we have ever had who had served in combat in the military. He was an artillery officer in World War I. Anybody else who was in the military was like President Jimmy Carter, a naval engineer. They had never served in combat. Now we get to the Clinton and Obama era in which they've never even been in the military. But because of his military experience, Truman knew he was facing a need to negotiate. And so when he negotiated the ceasefire, the military hated him. And even when he won the election in 1948, he's holding up that newspaper that says on the headlines, Dewey beats Truman.
Right.
They even put in the headlines that his enemy would beat him even though he won. That's why he was holding that headline up. Then when he became the president, he immediately faced an assassination attempt. As a matter of fact, it was, let me see, it was... I can't remember the date it was exactly, but it was actually 2 weeks before that election in which they produced that headline of Dewey beats Truman. Just 2 weeks before that election was won, Puerto Rican nationalists stormed Blair House, where Truman was living while the White House was being renovated, and the assassination attempt failed. But the White House policeman stationed outside was murdered, and another was wounded inside in a machine gun fusillade that totally trashed the Blair House lobby. And had the assassins just waited another 20 minutes, they would have killed the 33rd president of the United States. And what's so funny about this is that there was no such thing as Puerto Rico being a state in the Union. So Puerto Rican secessionists trying to kill the president seems highly suspicious.
Right.
But, you know, even after he won, the Republicans scored 52% of the vote in the 1950 congressional elections. His own party got a mere 42%. He saw its majority in the Senate cut from 12 to 2, in the House and in the House from 17 to 12. And in 1951, when the peace treaty with Japan was signed at the Presidio Military Base in San Francisco, the newspapers blared all kinds of stories about corruption and American aides to Truman selling out to the Japanese. And what happened was seven members of Truman's administration, including some of his closest aides, went to jail. And nobody remembers this today, but when Eisenhower finally became president, he was warning against the military-industrial complex. This is what he was talking about.
Right.
And so the military-industrial complex totally destroyed Truman for negotiating with the Japanese because they felt they had lost. Mm-hmm. And that feeling was to carry on in Korea and in Vietnam, and we're still living with that at the highest levels of the U.S. military. The problem is now the American public believes the myth, and the American public has bought the myth that America won that World War totally, irrevocably. And it's led to this belief in infallibility in atomic weapons and the American military that we need to view with skepticism and, indeed, with cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
But what other questions might be coming out of the chat room? Because if I was going to talk about the submarines and their part in the negotiated ceasefire.
Right. Well, let me scroll up a little bit because the chat room is moving pretty fast.
Right.
And maybe what might be the best here is...
You want to talk about the crewmen?
Well, let's take... I want to get into that during the last hour, but it seems that most... The biggest debate in the chat room right now is the whole, you know, just kind of like we were talking about. Did the U.S. win the war, you know, World War, or was it, you know, really Japan kind of thing? And it seems that's where a lot are getting... you know, there's a little bit of a debate in that, and maybe a little clarification, and then maybe to just... maybe we can pinpoint it a little bit more in terms of exactly, you know, why, you know, you're saying, well, we didn't win the war, in fact.
That is correct. And what had happened was that, let me give you an example. If you take a look at an American, he thinks World War II is from 1941 to 1945
right.
in the Pacific, so it's 5 years. If you ask the average Japanese on the home islands in Japan, World War II, they'll say it's a 15-year war. For them, it was 1931 to 1945 when they first landed in Manchuria.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you ask Japanese living in Brazil, how long was World War II? They'll tell you 20 years. They'll say 1931 to 1951 when the peace treaty was signed at the Presidio Military Base in San Francisco. And the reason they think that was because they participated very heavily in the final stages of the war, and that's where the submarines come in. Basically, the atomic bombs that were developed at Korea were put on the I-400 submarines, and the I-Giants are pictured in the section called Japan Goes Nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see the I-Giants sitting at Pearl Harbor. There's three of them. One of them is what's called an I-Teen, which would launch basically reconnaissance planes that were used to observe the forest fires in the Pacific Northwest. The other two are I-400s, and what they carried were bombers. And they carried three each in their tubular hangars, and there's a size comparison. If you take a look at the little model submarine at the end between how big an I-400 submarine is with how small an American conventional submarine is, then you realize that these submarines were the largest submarines to ever exist in the history of mankind until the advent of a nuclear submarine.
Right.
And in terms of what they were carrying, if you see that one photo with the Okas on the I-10, it says the I-14 in that painting, and you see an American bomber trying to strafe that submarine. What that submarine is launching is Oka, which are piloted rockets. And these piloted rockets were used operationally. That's why it's called an I-10. It's a smaller submarine. It was used in theater, in region near Japan, to attack destroyers and various other concentrations of American ships. But the I-400s, the larger submarines, were strategic. They carried bombers such as the Peggy, and that is up there between the I-Giants at Pearl Harbor that are sitting there that were turned in by the Japanese. That Peggy plane was what was used to deliver atomic bombs if Hirohito gave the order. Now, what happened was there were three Peggies on each of the I-400s still extant. Again, Emperor Hirohito had laid down the keel for 17 I-400 class submarines. By the end of the war, there were about seven of them that were built. Two of them were ordered to surrender to the Americans to present the threat, and the Americans used prize crew member sailors to sail them back to the Pacific West Coast, where they could be studied and analyzed and proven to be workable. Then they were flown back to the Pacific and ultimately sunk, so the public would never find out about them. A third one was sunk in 1946 off Gotu Island, G-O-T-U Island, and that was sunk in 1946, still at sea. Now, each one of these submarines, because they were conventional, was always accompanied by a fleet of 30 smaller submarines, one which would carry nothing but fuel, one which would carry nothing but water, some which would carry nothing but medical supplies. These were like specialist subs, so it was an underwater aircraft carrier with an escort fleet.
Huh.
Now, these remained at sea at all times until the emperor gave them the coded order to either turn themselves in or to launch. That's how American and Soviet submarines later on developed that policy where they would launch only on command from their executives. And so Emperor Hirohito developed that strategically. Now, during the war, we have to ask, well, how did he, by that I mean, from 1945, after the ceasefire, to 1951, how did he prevent the Americans from throwing him into prison or executing him for war crimes? These submarines were part of that. They were still at sea, still a threat. He maintained them with over $100 billion that he kept in a Swiss bank account. And that was because he controlled, as the emperor, pretty much the Japanese economy and had an investment and a huge share of stock into every single major Japanese industry. So towards the end of the war, he had over $100 billion. This is in 1990 dollars, about the time I was working with some files concerning Emperor Hirohito's Swiss bank accounts, because there was legal action. The Americans were trying to get them out of Switzerland. There was still legal action that they were losing concerning getting his stuff out of Switzerland. And what happened was he had $100 billion in 1990 terms, so in 1945 terms, it must have been like almost $200 billion
worth. Yeah, it had been a lot of money either way you go.
Yeah, but he was financing this private fleet, and where did they refuel? In the southern Philippines, in Mindanao, where the Muslims hated the Americans. Now, I worked with documents concerning the Muslim genocide against Filipino Muslims during the Spanish-American War. The Americans killed 3 million Filipino Muslims, men, women, and children, during the Spanish-American War, and since that time, they hated the Americans. Since that time, it's been a clearinghouse for terrorists. Tim McVeigh's partner, Terry Nichols, married a Filipino Muslim, and he was converted to bombing the Oklahoma City buildings because of what she had told him about what the Americans had done to her family. Bobby Fischer married a Filipino Muslim. And when he moved to the Philippines, he was found out about what the Americans had done to the Filipino Muslims. He started raving against America and saying America deserved 9-1-1. And so you have this connection to the Filipino Muslims still fighting America. It goes all the way through the terrorist campaigns that are ongoing today. They are still fighting for severance from Catholic Filipino North. And the Americans have been helping the Catholic Filipino North to occupy them for many years. So the Japanese, one of the largest Japanese cities in the world outside of Japan, was in Filipino-Muslim-dominated Mindanao, on the city of Davao, D-A-V-A-O. The city of Davao was predominantly Japanese. It stayed there after the war. Even after the Americans retook the Philippines, a large amount of Japanese people stayed there because everyone thought they were Filipino. And if you say, how's that possible? If you take a look at the movie Krakatoa, East of Java, that was about the big explosion of a volcano in Indonesia during the 1800s, Krakatoa, East of Java, shows Japanese women who look just like Filipinos. They act Filipino. They're Filipino enculturated, but they speak Japanese. Huh. That's how acclimated they became to Filipino culture. They show that in that popular film. It does a great job of showing you what you're dealing with when the Japanese who stayed on the Philippines were able to help these subs refuel even after the war. The other place where they refueled and where they stocked up on revisions or provisions, excuse me, was over at São Paulo. And São Paulo in Brazil had the largest population of Japanese in the world outside of Japan, period. And they started settling there in the 1900s. And what happened was they were the poorer Japanese. There were 200,000 of them in São Paulo as opposed to about 100,000 in the United States. And so they had twice as many Japanese in Brazil as they had in the U.S. The Brazilian government refused to inter them during the war. And even though it declared war on Japan and Germany at American behest, the Brazilian government allowed its Japanese to remain free. And the Japanese reciprocated by investing heavily in Brazilian development. And they, at Sao Paulo, basically continued to help refuel these submarines, which would then threaten the American East Coast. Not the West Coast, but actually Washington, D.C. and New York. And so this went on until 1951 when the emperor gave the orders for the Japanese sent over submarines to self-destruct and scuttle when the peace treaty was signed. Then he knew his position was unassailable. That's when he brought a bunch of money back from Switzerland to help restart the Japanese economy. And that explains why in Brazil, when Japanese author Yukio Mishima, famous author, Mishima, M-I-S-H-I-M-A. He's famous even in the United States as a novelist. When he ultimately tried to hold a coup to bring the imperial family back into power, Yukio Mishima, when he visited Brazil, found out from the Brazilian Japanese that the Japanese had never lost the war, or rather negotiated the peace from a position of strength as opposed to a position of weakness. That's when he converted to radicalism and militancy. So that is essentially a dynamic which most Americans are totally unaware of. They have no idea of what had happened at the end of the war and are blissfully ignorant of that. But this is what brought us into the nuclear age of constant ceasefire agreements, peace negotiations. This is how that all started, because otherwise it wouldn't make sense. Here goes this total war. America kicks total ass. It totally destroys these powers and then suddenly winds up pussyfooting around in Korea and Vietnam. How on earth does that seem like a coherent picture to anyone in terms of and here were the negotiated settlements, the opening of American markets to Japanese, which otherwise never would have happened. If you take a look at, say, for instance, popular culture, such as the belief that whoever America goes to war with, they help rebuild, you only have to look at the immense poverty in Vietnam for many years until very recently, the immense poverty in the Philippines, where Americans went to war with the Spanish Empire, or Cuba, or Angola. Whoever America has gone to war with has remained in abject poverty. But suddenly in World War II, you get Germany and Japan who negotiate this opening of markets, and they're selling their products to the Americans and making this killing on the economic market to the point where their economies are super revitalized, and now it's the American industry that's dead meat in the water and being bailed out. Huh. That can't happen except from a position of negotiated strength. Right. And I think it's only at this point in history that the American public, certainly the younger people, can come to grips with the reality of that and say we've got to build a new reality based on the facts. We are all allowed our choice of opinions. Every single one of us can have as many opinions as he wants. None of us are allowed our choice of facts. And what I am presenting are the facts. There is nothing that I am putting up on UFOPilotsBlogspot.com that is a fictitious picture. All of those photos are real. Right. And paintings that were done, that painting of the I-14 launching the Okas, that was a military commissioned painting to show Americans what they would be facing if they could identify that submarine. And so that is kind of an example of how not necessarily that America lost the war, but America did not negotiate the peace from a position of strength, and in a sense it did lose the war, and here's how. America lost the war against the Seminole Indians in Florida because originally it was a war of extermination. The Seminole Indians, thanks to enormous British support, such as British special forces in the early days, that sharpshooters that were sent in to aid them, basically forced the Americans to sign a position of peace treaty with them, which allowed them enough autonomy where they dominated the swamps of Florida. And one of the facts that they won was the fact that they're half blackified because many escaped slaves would go into the swamps and live with the Seminole Indians. Hmm. And then the Seminole Indians became, in a sense, half black because of the enormous amount of slaves they sheltered. My point is that when two Seminole Indians got into a fight with FBI men in the 1980s, they were brought to trial because they had killed the two FBI men, and they were released because it was found out they were still legally at war with the United States, so they had not committed murder. Now, if you go to the Japanese situation, the American attitude was a policy of total extermination. And it was when Admiral Halsey said, when this war is over, Japanese will be a language spoken only in hell. He was articulating state policy. Life magazine told its readers on June 11, 1945, total war calls for total defeat. That means that the war-making power of every Japanese resource, every Japanese man, woman, and child must be destroyed. Mm. And that was published in, you know, basically, you know, you can still access that. That's out there. Life magazine's picture of the week, which I show on let me see, it's on Blogspot, but I show that photo of the woman looking at the Japanese skull. That's on The Bombs That Failed. You'll see the tank mascot, that Japanese head that's mounted on a truck, and the Japanese woman looking at the skull. I'll explain that. Life magazine's picture of the week, May 22nd, 1944, that's what that is. That occupied a full page. It showed Natalie Richardson. She's 20 years old. She was a war worker in Phoenix, Arizona. She's looking at the Japanese skull. Her boyfriend, Lieutenant W.F.J. Wyman, sent back home under the picture, under the caption, Arizona war worker writes her Navy boyfriend a thank you note for Jeff's skull he sent her. People would send home Japanese skulls to use as paperweights. Customs officials on the U.S. West Coast found enormous numbers of boxes coming back from the Pacific that contained Japanese jawbones, skulls with autographs from everybody in the platoon, you know, and everybody thought of the Japanese workers, as of the Japanese as subhuman. Truck drivers would mount the Japanese skulls on all their trucks, paint it in different colors. They would wear the, they would put them on the fenders of the trucks as decorations. Necklaces were made from the teeth of dead Japanese soldiers. Collarbones were used as knife, paper knives and letter openers. President Roosevelt, on August 10th, announced that he was using a letter opener that was made from the jawbone of a young Japanese soldier. Hmm. So that shows you the depth at which the Americans wanted to basically exterminate the Japanese. As a matter of fact, the Awamaru, which was a Japanese hospital boat in April 1945, I know this because I was born in Taiwan, the Awamaru, A-W-A, and then Maru meaning Japanese word for ship, the Awamaru was sunk in April 1945 with a Red Cross on it. It was a hospital ship. It was loaded with 2,000 Japanese refugees, and everyone could see it was a Red Cross. Everyone knew it was a hospital ship loaded with refugees, but Commander Hoffman of the U.S. Navy sunk the hospital ship, and he was promoted to Rear Admiral for doing that. So the Americans said, we've got to kill the Japanese right down to every single last one of them, and then suddenly all of that changed. So in that sense, because the Japanese are still here, they won the war, and the Americans lost.
Right.
Because it was a war of extermination, and the Americans failed. As a matter of fact, as when the ceasefire was declared, Japan's biggest problem was overpopulation.
Not right. Yeah. Oh. Well, I tell you what, Douglas, we're at the top of the hour again. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to get more into the ties with Roswell, and of course some of the pilots and some of that. Because very interesting stuff. So we'll be back in a moment with our guest, Douglas Dietrich. Welcome back, everybody. Tonight we've been talking with Douglas Dietrich, and a lot of information coming at you tonight. But of course, we always encourage you to take it upon yourself to research, look up this stuff. And, you know, one of the biggest things we hear about, you know, in dealing with shows like this, I mean, not this show in particular tonight, but shows that cover topics along these lines, is you can't believe what you read or hear, but you know, that's why you got to dig it up yourself and find out. But you know, it's really some interesting stuff. And Douglas, you know, we've talked about all these things, and it's basically, you know, for tonight's show leading up to Roswell. What exactly happened at Roswell? I mean, obviously, you know, this was a case that really sat dead for almost, I think it was like about 25, 30 years, until a man, which most people who listen to this show would know as Stanton Friedman, came along and began basically shedding some light on it, maybe, you know, in terms of just bringing it attention. And how does all this, you know, I mean, a lot of people definitely buy into the UFO crash, the, you know, the other things that, that have also been brought out about Roswell, you know, through Friedman and, of course, now other people's research. So what we've been talking about tonight, where does, you know, where does that leave it then? So in that terms, I mean, you're basically saying, you know, this wasn't an alien crash.
That's right. And the thing to remember about Stanton Friedman is that he was not the first to bring up the Roswell crash after the initial silencing. The initial silencing was so terroristic, so thorough in terms of its intimidation of the Roswell public that they went so far, for instance, as to wipe Jesse Marceau Sr.'s record clean. And I want to put it out there because I don't know if Jesse Marceau Jr., even is aware of this or if he's not aware of it, but his father was a hero. His father served in the B-17s, I believe, and they were over the European theater, and he was a brave man and an intelligent man. I believe he was a ball turret gunner. He was responsible for shooting down two planes. His plane was shot down once, and when he survived the war, he was given a series of medals. And what had happened was that, it was B-24s, forgive me. He had been a pilot of B-24s over Europe, and he won 5 air medals, specifically. Now, I saw his records.
Right.
He had downed 5 enemy aircraft, as a matter of fact, now that I look at my notes. But the point was, and he was shot down himself once. Okay, when I looked at his records, the orders were right on his records, wipe this clean. And so when he was presented to the U.S. public, he was presented as a charlatan and a fraud. He was disgraced.
Yeah.
He spent the rest of his life as a TV repairman in Roswell. And his son spent the rest of his life overcompensating for his dad's embarrassment and shame in public by becoming a medical doctor through the U.S. Army. And now at the age of between 60 and 70 is flying helicopters for medevac in Iraq.
Yeah.
Still to this day. And whether he knows the true story about what they did to his father or not, I do not know. But I'm here to tell him his dad's a hero, and his dad was a victim. And when his father was silenced by General Ramey and that crowd, think of what, if they were willing to do that to one of their own, think of what they did to the public in Roswell. So that case was silenced. And it remained silent for, as you say, about 20 years. But the first people to talk about was Charles Berlitz and a friend of his who wrote a book on Roswell. And then suddenly Stanton Friedman jumped in. He took over the project. Now, a bit about Stanton Friedman's background. Stanton Friedman designed the Convair NB-36. And if you look at Collateral Technologies, under that section of the UFO pilots.blogspot.com, anyhow, if you look under Collateral Technologies, the first picture is the Convair NB-36. And it says at the bottom of it, please link to other Collateral Technologies, nuclear flight in parentheses. That's another picture of the Convair NB-36. Stanton Friedman worked on that plane. That was not a collateral technological development in any way, shape, or form due to the Roswell technology or Japanese balloon bomb technology. But like I said, between my Brazilian co-researchers, broken English and my fractured Portuguese, that was the best we were able to classify it as.
Right.
But Stanton Friedman worked on nuclear flight. And so Stanton Friedman was responsible for this plane that was so dangerous that the majority of people who piloted it are dead because of radiation poisoning.
Hmm.
And every time it flew over farms, the joke was made that it was microwaving chickens in their coops. And it was referred to jokingly as SLAM, slow, low, and messy. And it was accompanied at all times by a escort of several planes that kept it within radial circumspection so that if it ever crashed, several of these planes, which are transport planes carrying U.S. Army Rangers, could cordon off the area immediately and recover it so that the radiation spill could be covered up.
Hmm.
So this occurred at a time when the Americans cared so little for public safety that events took place such as what I described to you at one point in a private conversation between us of what happened in North Carolina, where you had, say, for instance, on January 24th, 1961, a B-52 with two nukes aboard that leaked fuel and exploded in midair, and its nukes each of which was 4 megatons, 250 times as powerful as the bomb that decimated Hiroshima. They basically fell into fields in North Carolina and are still there to this day because they're too dangerous to remove. They just, the government just bought the land and left them there to rot, and they're still afraid they might explode. So Stanton Friedman's working with all this technology. Then he shows up and says Roswell was aliens, and now he emcees the ceremonies at the Roswell parade pretty much annually.
Right.
And so you really got to ask yourself, why is he, what is he getting out of this? What is he covering up? And not only that, why does he live in Canada? It's interesting that after he received so many complaints concerning his project and the leakage of radiation and what it was doing to, you know, in terms of safety for the U.S. public, that he decided he was going to pull up pegs, move up to Canada, and become a Canadian citizen. So Stanton Friedman has a lot basically to hide about himself. And he basically has said the same story for about 20 years now. He can go on one show and say something. He'll say it again verbatim on the next show that he's on half an hour later. He can repeat the same story in his sleep because of the paucity of the information that he provides. So I think we pretty much dignified him with enough attention at this moment concerning what he's saying. But if you go to the experience that the Roswellites themselves went through,
right,
they're going to grab at anything that can give them a viable economy, because during the Lyndon Baines Johnson administration, the local Army Air Base was pulled out and moved to Texas, where Lyndon Baines Johnson came from. And everybody who comes from Texas, whether it's Bush Sr., Bush Jr., or people who claim they're Texans, like Bush Sr. or Bush Jr., they buy the economy of Texas by moving in more military bases. Matter of fact, you can go jogging in Texas, and you can jog for maybe about 50 minutes. You're bound to run into 3 different military bases. Right. I mean, this, Texas is loaded with it, and our economy floats on it, and it's pulled out of places like Roswell, which are left to rot on the vine. And so the Roswellites are suddenly presented by Stanton Friedman and by the subsequent alien tourism that came after with a viable economy. And the point is that this is what they depend on, so they are obligated to stand behind that. And if that myth dies, their economy dies. Mm. And so what we're doing tonight is we're threatening the livelihood of a community. And I'm not doing this because I'm a mean person. I'm doing this because it's childhood's end for America in general, and this is part of that process. And so when we take a look at what happened to Jesse Marceau Sr., and we take a look at what happened to the Roswellites, it is better to bring them justice than it is to bring them profit.
All right.
I mean, would you rather sell out your soul for the sake of feeding your mouth?
All right.
And so what I'm saying to the Roswellites is that they can reconfigure their economy by perhaps catering to Japanese tourism. And then people like Hayakawa, who lives in New Mexico and is a Japanese guy who has worked at, you know, bringing attention to Area 51, various other areas in ufology, he could serve as one of the viable members in opening up a new economy for Roswell that would be geared towards Japanese tourism, because the highest amount of visitors to Pearl Harbor are Japanese. I don't see why they wouldn't want to visit a place as beautiful as New Mexico. And in terms of the people who are pushing the Roswell alien theme, we have people like Lieutenant Corso. What is so interesting is that one of the people that Truman beat when he was elected president was Senator Strom Thurmond. And Strom Thurmond was a Dixiecrat who later on Philip J. Corso approached to write a foreword for his book. Well, he was blatantly a liar because he told Thurmond, he gave him a different manuscript for a book called I Walked with Giants, which was Corso's memoirs about World War II, had nothing to do with UFOs or conspiracies at all. And when Strom Thurmond wrote the introduction for that book, suddenly it appears in The Day After Roswell, and Thurmond protested loudly and publicly and sued and forced the removal of that foreword from subsequent editions of The Day After Roswell. So Corso's integrity is out the window from the beginning. And so we're confronted with, well, what happened there? Well, one of the things that happened was you get an ambulance driver who brings in 3 bodies in through the South Gate that were initially at the Plains of San Agustin. And what happened was when that pilot, and this needs to be explained, the crewmen of the gondola were very short Japanese in this sense, keep remembering that the Japanese at the time of World War II never ate meat. There was no such thing as meat in the Japanese diet until 1945, when American troops brought in beef. And until that time, the closest to meat Japanese would eat would be fish. So every Japanese subsisted on a few calories a day. They were a third world nation with a heavy industry, and their average height was about 5 feet tall. And so the point is that when they captured American prisoners, this was one of the reasons why American prisoners of war died at 7 times the rate in Japanese prisoner of war camps than they died in Nazi prison camps, was because the Japanese would feed them, per the rules of the Geneva Convention, half of what the Japanese soldier ate in the field. So a Japanese man giving an American guy raised on beef half of what he eats to an American, you may as well give him bait. So the Americans are dying off, and they're now suddenly they're confronted at Roswell with these Japanese guys who are even shorter. And one of the things that the Japanese had to deal with was Senjin-kun. No Japanese would ever voluntarily surrender. And for people who disbelieve that, I remember when I first brought this up, how people were saying, oh, it can't be true that the Japanese are a multi-ethnic society and that the Taiwanese and the Koreans and Okinawans who are working for them are doing all the surrendering. Well, that's what happened. Americans used to write down Jap surrender, Jap surrender. They couldn't tell these people. They all spoke Japanese. They couldn't tell their ethnicity. So all of these people were Okinawan, Taiwanese, and Koreans. And like the Welsh and the Irish and Scots, who formed Scots Guards, Welsh Guards, Irish units, they were ethnic units within the Japanese Army the way those Celtic units were within the British Army. But in terms of what happened is that when they did surrender, then the Americans wrote them down as Japanese. And one of the reasons a Japanese soldier would never surrender, and I'll explain it to you, basically their own doctors, whenever American troops would surrender, this happened at Guadalcanal, for instance, Japanese doctors would practice their surgery techniques on prisoners of war, and that way they could work on the Japanese more safely later, the Japanese patients. So Japanese doctors would also operate on prisoners of war without anesthesia so that they would save the anesthesia for their own men. So if your own doctors are doing that to troops that are surrendering, what would they do to you if you surrendered to them?
Yeah.
So the average Japanese soldier is never going to surrender, never did. And so those the surrenders that happened, quote-unquote, were Japanese troops that were captured unconscious due to mortal wounds, were usually brought into prison camps unconscious. When they awoke, they would pull their IVs out, charge the machine gun nest and die, or wrap themselves in barbed wire or razor wire and force themselves to bleed out. So this happened in entire camps would have massacres like this of Japanese suiciding en masse. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of a Japanese soldier being ordered to surrender without even firing a shot by the emperor, this was a very sensitive area. So what the emperor turned to were the Yakuza. And the Yakuza were Japanese gangsters, the samurai mafia. And one of the sign marks of a Japanese gangster is that he will always basically apologize for his mistakes very early in his career by cutting off his pinky finger. So by the time a Yakuza graduates to a accepted level as a made man in the Japanese mafia, he has basically lost both of his pinkies. Right. So when the Japanese emperor said to the mafia, we need crews of your shortest men who are often third worlders, the poorest of the poor, to pilot these gondolas, we're train them, the mafia responded enthusiastically, just as the American mafia responded during World War II to helping the American government with intelligence. That's another story. Most Americans are familiar with that. Lucky Luciano and his deal with the U.S. government, etc. But in terms of the Japanese mafia, short crewmen were selected. They had 4 fingers. They had one thumb. They had gloves with grips on them to compensate for the lack of a pinky. These gloves were burned. They were rubbery gloves. They were burned directly into their skin when they immolated and the dirigible caught fire. And the emperor ordered them to kill themselves at the earliest possible opportunity to make sure the Americans weren't able to get too much out of this technology. What the Americans did get was when the crew surrendered themselves, the Americans were presented with these crewmen. They said, well, let's try and use this technology to our advantage. Let's see if this gondola with the dirigible can carry a nuke, because if the Russians ever do get the bomb and they nuke us, they're going to destroy all the airfields just like we did in Germany and Japan, and we'll have to lift off vertically. Can this thing, if it can lift up this gondola, which is so heavy, it should be able to lift one of our bombers. Right. Let's see if the gondola can carry a nuke. So in the Roswell case, they put a nuke on the gondola, and when it was lifted by the gondola, on the night of July 2nd, a storm came out of nowhere. That's what happens in Roswell. That's what happens in New Mexico. Storms come out of nowhere in the desert. When the storm came out, the American escort planes lost all sight of it, and that's when the crewmen got up and fired the flare into the dirigible, and it blew. An explosion that was heard by hundreds of people. And when it did blow, of course, the guy who blew it got sucked up into the vortex. His body wound up in front of Mark Brazel's ranch. The others that were in the gondola, when it separated due to the explosion and blew, they wound up on the plains of San Agustin. And there was a third section, which contained the bomb, which wound up in the Proctor site. And the De Proctor site is almost never heard of or mentioned.
Yeah.
But that's because the De Proctor site, which is just north of the Brazel Ranch, that was 2.5 miles from the Mac Brazel site. Basically, the Americans cordoned that off right away and were able to find the bomb immediately. And they grabbed that up, and they took back this Volkswagen-sized cylinder back to base, and that was the fused bomb. The bomb didn't blow. It just fused in the enormous heat, but they were afraid it would blow, even with fried circuits. So they had to cordon it off, bring it back immediately. And, of course, all of this makes sense. The U.S. government would never respond that quickly if it were something totally unexpected, like an alien crash landing. As a matter of fact, when the U.S. Army brought it back, they wouldn't tell the FBI about it because then they wouldn't get the budget they wanted for an Air Force if the FBI spread the news. So J. Edgar Hoover, in 1947, said, "I must insist upon full access to the disk recovered. The Army grabbed one and would not let us have it for cursory examination." Now, I ask you, if an alien plane or vehicle really crashed in the, on American soil, would the U.S. Air Force, in any sensible or sane world, be able to hide that from the FBI?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. Obviously, they were covering up their own mistakes. They're covering up what they're working with. And again, if people try and say, well, we had a VTOL system, okay, that could lift nukes. Okay, the helicopters wouldn't work. At that point, we did not have helicopters large enough to lift an atomic bomb, which is quite heavy. The dirigibles were not accessible to the U.S. Army because they were Navy. That was the U.S. Naval Air Service, and there was an enormous rivalry at that time because Admiral Arleigh Burke was supporting a development of a seaplane strike force based on those Japanese submarines that were able to launch planes. If you take a look at the Japan Goes Nuclear section on ufopilots.blogspot.com, the first photo you see is a skate plane, which is an American experimental seaplane fighter on a sub, a miniature drone submarine. That was an American creation based on Japanese technology learned from the Japanese catapult launches of planes from their giant subs. So Admiral Arleigh Burke said, "We don't need carriers. Carriers concentrate firepower, and all of our air power can be knocked out in one blow in a real war." The golden age of carriers was only a few months in the Pacific. There were more battleship-to-battleship battles in the Pacific than there were carrier-to-carrier battles. And so people don't understand that because the carriers got all the play because they were glamorous. But the reality was they were obsolete very quickly. And what happened was the U.S. Navy said, if we can get the seaplane strike force, we don't need carriers. We can hide hundreds of seaplanes, fighters, bombers, transports in atolls and coves all over the Pacific, and no one would be able to bomb them all at once, and we could strike anywhere in Asia just like that with nuclear bombs. And the Air Force said, God, if the Navy develops a nuclear strike capability, they won't need a strategic airplane force, an Air Force, so we'll lose everything. Mm-hmm. So at very high levels, the Army won out, and they were able to get their Air Force, and the Navy seaplane strike budget was cut. So what you see there is not a dead-end technology in terms of that skate parked on that drone sub. You see a dead-end budget.
All right.
And so the Navy was stuck with, okay, let's just build bigger carriers. They're useless in real war, but we can pummel Vietnam with them. We can pummel Korea with it. We can fight these colonial wars. And since that time, that's all the U.S. Navy has done, is it fights colonial wars. If it were a real war, one tactical nuke would take out one carrier and billions of dollars of U.S. assets, bam, just like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the point that is going on is the Navy lost, and they, at that time, were still vying for budget control. They wouldn't give the Air Force their blimps. So they weren't going to lend Navy blimps to the Air Force. So the Navy, the Army Air Corps. So the Army Air Corps says, let's work with these Japanese gondolas. And not only that, but the Japanese Army Air Corps, when they loaded them up with nukes and whatnot, in terms of learning whether they could lift nukes, you have to remember that the Army Air Corps had to let the Japanese fly them because there wasn't a single American who could fit in the bloody gondola. The only way an American could fit in that gondola was if he was a dwarf, and height requirements wouldn't allow dwarves in the U.S. for military,
right,
or if
yeah.
he was a child, and they weren't about to put a child in a gondola with a nuke. So they were stuck with, hey, let's use the Japs. And then they put the Japanese in there, and of course the Japanese, who had been hiding flares in their anuses, would pull them out, blow the dirigible and immolate themselves, and all that technology. Some of the things the Americans got out of this that went to Patel and reverse engineering corporations, it was basically a titanium nickel composite. And that's where it brings us to collateral technologies. That was a collateral technology. If you see collateral technologies, that first section on ufopilots.blogspot.com,
right.
You see the Douglas stiletto profile, that thin pencil thing, the Douglas X-3 stiletto, and that comes right after Stanton Friedman's plane, that fabulous nuclear plane, a flying submarine, basically, a flying nuclear submarine. The Douglas stiletto was built entirely out of titanium. So the Americans said in the 1950s, let's build our own Oka-piloted bomb with a made totally out of titanium just for the sake of finding out if the engineering stresses can match that of what the Japanese developed. Now, for people who don't understand the mentality here, I refer them to collateral technologies, the last one on the bottom, right after Japan goes nuclear, that section. The first picture that you see there is a U.S. kamikaze. And that is a U.S. kamikaze, and after that, the next picture is a summary giving some details on that. That was commissioned in 1945, and that was commissioned by the Americans to do battle with the Japanese bombers if the Japanese started sending bombers at the U.S. because the Japanese kamikazes had proven so effective. So the Americans said, we need a piloted ramjet that can crash, body crash into Japanese bombers headed our way. They commissioned that in 1945. Which shows you how desperate the situation was.
Right, yeah.
And so when you go off to the Douglas stiletto, and the only thing that stopped that from being mass-produced was the ceasefire. And that was how important the timeline is of what I'm saying. These guys show up from nowhere in this gondola. They present, oh, we got nuclear capability. They present the ultimatum. The Americans at that point knew about the Patsy bombers because they already gave them a code name. The fact that they gave them a code name shows they knew about them. They were already commissioning kamikaze aircraft to crash, body crash into them if they came over American airspace. All of that desperation gets stopped by the ceasefire. They say, okay, we can demobilize. That was one of the ceasefire conditions. Then they say, okay, let's do things with a spin-off technology like building this Douglas stiletto completely out of titanium. And so that is an example of collateral technology. But titanium mixed with nickel is not an alien composite. There is nothing in that technology that the Americans reverse engineered that is extraterrestrial. Mm. All of that comes straight out of Asia. And so when people are saying, well, what about the bodies? Well, at the plains of San Agustin, where the other part of the dirigible crashed without the nuke, which ejected, when that crashed on the plains of San Agustin, there were three dead Japanese, one of them who was weeping because he was in incredible pain because the parts of his body that were exposed were totally burned, namely his face. His gloves were so hot they were melted into his hands. The Americans came, and the first thing that this one lady who saw them, I forget the female's name, Gerald Anderson. When Gerald Anderson saw them, she said the American soldier went right up and started beating the Japanese guy with a rifle butt. Now, does anyone do that to an alien from another planet who crash lands on your planet? No, of course not. It doesn't make any sense except as a prisoner of war scenario. And there was a reporter from Life magazine who was called on site to report on the crash. He was handed a 45 caliber handgun, and he was told, watch out, we got, we don't know what's going to happen here. This is standard POW procedure. Any of the press are armed to keep themselves safe in case the POWs escape.
Right.
The POW from Life magazine, I forget his name right now, but, he's fairly easy to look up because he actually wrote about that in multiple interviews with Stanton Friedman. But perhaps more importantly, Dr. Curry Holden, the Texas Tech anthropologist who was leading a student archaeological expedition, saw these bodies and the living Japanese person as well, and testified to support what the female Gerald Anderson was saying. Also, Soil Conservation Service employee Grady Barnett, a civil engineer, verified all this. You have multiple witnesses that these people were spotted, and they were in their silver, shiny asbestos suits. The Americans finally surround them. They bring them back in, the dead ones. Then suddenly the ambulance driver, private first class, Irvin Fortman, brings in three bodies through the south gate. Then they say, oh, God, we need these tiny children's coffins to the our friend Dennis, who runs the mortuary over there. And I forget his first name now, but Glenn Dennis. Mm-hmm. So Glenn Dennis, when he tries to get the child coffins ready, the U.S. Air Force, again, not the U.S., the government, the U.S. Air Force countermands his story about that later on in the press by saying, officially, and they said this officially, they said, we use infant coffins to transport whiskey and other alcohol on airplanes, a smuggling technique we learned to foil enlisted men from pilfering our officers' alcohol supply.
Yeah.
So what are they telling you? What they're telling you officially is that they drink on duty while messing with nuclear bombs.
All right.
That's what they're telling you, because every base has a bar that you can legally drink in, and if they don't, like Area 51, they have a watering hole right nearby. As a matter of fact, the only reason we know so much about Area 51 is because everybody goes to the watering hole in the city nearby, and let me see if I can remember the name of that city. I believe it's Rachel. Rachel is right outside of Area 51, and all the Area 51 employees go there to drink.
Right.
So that's why we know so much about Area 51. So you are free to drink off base if you want to get bombed and stoned out of your mind, and they have bars on base to do so at a more, shall we say, subdued level. So when the officers are telling you they're smuggling in alcohol, and they admit that officially, the only conclusion you can draw is they're telling you, we drink on duty
right.
at your tax expense while we mess with your bombs. That's what they're telling you. So when they present you the 509th Bomber Group, the composite bomber group, these are the guys who dropped the atom bomb. By God, they know it all. They're the best of the best. They're the best and the brightest. They themselves are telling you, we're alcoholics. And these are the officers. And these guys always flew bombs at 30,000 feet later on in the war to avoid Japanese aircraft, anti-aircraft fire, and Japanese ramming attacks. So these guys never saw a Japanese person in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they sure as hell weren't going to land in Japan and find out what Japanese people look like after what they dropped on them.
Right,
I can guarantee you that.
For sure.
So the when these guys are faced with these Japanese guys, they were out of a loop, the vast majority of them. And all of the sketches, and you can see them on the Asians as Aliens section, the types of extraterrestrials and the gondola crewman with the gloves. This is in the Asians as Aliens, the second section, right underneath the Hindenburg explosion
mm-hmm.
picture. You see the two types of aliens that are portrayed are obviously Japanese midgets. They are not a gray. And by that I mean Japanese very short people.
Right.
And these are based on these are by Bill McDonald. Bill McDonald is an amateur forensic pathologist. He used to be a private investigator. And he's taking these sketches from eyewitnesses, Master Sergeant Frank Kaufman and Leonard Stringfield. And he draws this little hybrid chick. Now, if that little hybrid chick didn't have the gray alien nuzzling her shoulder, trying to put the make on her, she would look like at your average Asian anchor woman, thousands of who were employed when Connie Chung became popular.
Right, yeah.
And then you look at the gondola crewman with the gloves, who's next on the picture down there. And again, I ask you, is that a gray alien or a Japanese man who shaved off his hair and eyebrows?
All right.
This is preposterous. And if you look at on the Bill McDonald website, on the Bill McDonald website himself, they're painted yellow. They're not gray. On the Bill McDonald website. And yet he still believes they're aliens. And that brings us up to the Asians as Aliens section, the first one with the Buck Rogers comics. These Buck Rogers comics, if you look at the date on all those comics, they're 1948. They're 1 year after Roswell. They show the evil Dr. Mortar of Saturn, and he is obviously the granddaddy of all alien greys. And he has a daughter who happens to be a sexy Latina. And all the men who are working for him, who Buck Rogers, by the way, calls gooks, in that comic strip, if you look at it, Buck Rogers is saying, stay back, gooks. oh, man, him and his girlfriend are walking along saying, I haven't seen a gook in blocks. You know, I mean, yeah, basically they're referring to them all as gooks. They're all obviously Asian. They could have portrayed in the Buck Rogers comic strip in 1948, 1 year after Roswell, they could have portrayed them as squids with cephalopodic heads and tentacular limbs, shall we say, right, or other organs. But instead, they portray Asians. Yeah. I seriously have to present this aliens and Asians dichotomy to you to show you the schizophrenia of the American mindset, because to the American mind, which had so dehumanized the Japanese throughout the war, to the point where if you take a look at the UC Berkeley Japanese bones, they are both in the bombs that failed section. You see the bone documents accepted by UC Berkeley, bones sent from the U.S. Soldiers at the front to UC Berkeley to keep in their anthropology department. And at the end, I have UC Berkeley Japanese bones by itself that you can link to. The Americans were so convinced that the Japanese would be exterminated as a race that UC Berkeley and other universities were asking troops to send Japanese bones to them so they could maintain them in museums. And they still do to this day against all the laws of the Geneva Convention concerning the treatment of dead prisoners. So I ask you, if the Japanese in the American mindset, certainly around that time, are not human, and after the war they're positively alien, what other conclusion could be drawn by the people who worked at Roswell, who all of them were young men who had never seen the Second World War other than in the 509th composite, and they had never landed on the ground in Japanese zones? How can any of these men be asked to identify Asians from aliens? And to say otherwise is kind of preposterous. And they never referred to them as aliens, even though the documents all did. All of the eyewitnesses say the little men. They all say the little men. Not a single one of them refers to them as aliens when they're asked in terms of eyewitness claims as to what they were seeing. So, I mean, with that in mind, we could go on for a while, but I think you get my point, and I certainly would like to entertain any challenges or questions from the audience, you know, concerning what's coming up in regards to what I'm saying, because nobody likes people that they respect in authority to be revealed or portrayed as ignorant bigots. And I'm not saying that they are. What I'm saying is that these men were not capable of interpreting what they were seeing unless they were inside the loop of the ceasefire negotiations that were still ongoing. And those ceasefire negotiations were so secret, and if you take a look at General Ishihira, he is under ceasefire conditions. He's the first person whose picture comes up there. When you take a look at what went on with him, he later on gave lectures to American doctors on the experience he had in terms of dealing with living human beings as biological warfare experiments, including American prisoners of war. And this guy walks out without a scratch, without being executed, without being tried as a war criminal. That's because these are ceasefire negotiations from a position of strength. No one would tolerate a man like that retiring as a full bird general after the war, and actually opening a medical company in Japan, medical company Green Cross, still one of the most respected medical companies in Japan today. How would this guy get away with that after spending 5 years in the U.S. unless he's negotiating for a position of threat?
Right. I tell you what, I mean, it's just very, really some interesting stuff. And, right now I don't see any questions from, you know, in the chat room right in front of me. I can definitely stroll up and see if we see any, but if anybody's in, if you're in the chat, not if anybody's in the chat room, obviously you're there. This is what happens when you try to do a longer show than you're used to. But yeah, if anybody's got any questions, send them through. I mean, we only have a few more minutes left, before, the end of the show. And I think we got one here, Douglas. Let me just double check it. All right, so this is so they're saying, which I think maybe. All right, World War II ended in 1945. Why and how and why were the Japanese trying to attack us with midgets and balloons in 1947? But it wasn't an attack, right?
That's correct. This was a technology exchange. Think of it as what the Nazi scientists were doing with our rockets. The Americans invented modern rocketry under Robert Goddard, and yet the Nazis built better rockets. So the Nazis were brought over here to show the Americans how to improve their rockets. The Japanese, on the other hand, invented this entire delivery system, which no one had conceived of beforehand. And the Americans were asking them during the ceasefire negotiations, well, since these men who turned themselves into us are prisoners of war, let's have them help us learn how to use this technology in a way that benefits us. Now, an American himself, Article number 3, I was in the Marine Corps, Article number 3 of the Code of Conduct for any prisoner of war for an American is, if I am captured, I will continue to resist by all means available. I will make every effort to escape and aid others to escape. I will accept neither parole nor special forces, or excuse me, nor special favors from the enemy. Mm-hmm. And so the Japanese version of that was even more strict and extreme. Theirs was, as soon as possible, I will kill myself.
Right.
And so that's what they were doing when they got the opportunities. The Americans basically think that they searched them adequately, but they couldn't search the cockpits because they couldn't fit inside.
Right.
And so the Americans, unless they were going to totally dismantle it, in which case it would no longer work, then they would have to allow the Japanese to show them how it was working, and they would try to derive what they could from observation. If people think something big in World War II can't be hidden, let me give you an example. Adolf Hitler in World War I in 1916, he suffered a mustard gas attack. After spending months recovering, he returned to the front with a real appreciation of the destructive chemical weapons. So after his rise to power, he gave the order to ensure that no German soldier would ever suffer as he did. So what he did was he made sure every single German soldier carried a gas mask and gas cape at all times in this cylindrical container. So this metal cylinder became a ubiquitous identifying sign of the German soldier throughout the war. And it turned out Adolf Hitler was right to expect gas attacks because on 1943, because the Americans didn't have the bomb and they had just started working on nuclear weapons and they were failing miserably, they tried to get Germany to sue for peace with a massive chemical gas attack, which was against all the laws of the Geneva Convention. And on December 2nd, 1943, after they had conquered Sicily, they were trying to get enough gas together to bomb the German cities of Dusseldorf and Cologne. And the German intelligence found out about it, and the Luftwaffe attacked the Italian port city of Bari, where all these U.S. merchantmen and ships were parked that contained thousands of tons of nerve gas, or rather chemical mustard gas. There's a difference between nerve and mustard gas. As someone who suffered from nerve gas before, I should differentiate that when I was in south of Kamisaya. But my point is that over 1,000 Allied military personnel died, and tens of thousands of Italians died because when the Germans attacked and bombed those ships, there was literally over 100 tons of 100-pound chemical gas bombs that were blown apart in several American merchant ships, floated all over the Italian city of Bari, and 20,000 civilians died and 1,000 American servicemen, and yet you've never heard of it. That was the worst damage the Allies suffered in terms of naval shipping since Pearl Harbor. 17 ships were destroyed. 8 others were damaged and taken out of the war. It was the merchantman SS John Harvey. You can look that up. The SS John Harvey itself alone had 100 tons of 100-pound mustard gas bombs. And when these bombs blew and floated over the city of Bari, the population was devastated. And after the war, the American government paid the Italian government, just don't talk about it anymore. We'll put all kinds of money into your economy. Just shut up about it. But in terms of the Italians, this is what led Mussolini to be able to establish the Salo Republic in the north, because many refugees from Bari came up there to rally to his cause, and for that reason, they wouldn't surrender to the British or the Americans. Instead, German and Italian units who were in the Salo Republic surrendered only to the Brazilians. When the Brazilians were brought up north, they took the Italian and German surrenders. They wouldn't surrender to the British or the Americans. But if you look up Bari, B-A-R-I, in December 2nd, 1943, you'll probably find something on it. But it will not give you anywhere near the detail I'm giving you on the type of chemical tragedy that took place there. So the American government, if they don't want you to hear about it, even if it turned the tide of the war the way that gas attack did, because that forced the invasion of Normandy, if it weren't for that gas catastrophe that anticipated Bhopal, India, you would never have had to have needed to invade Normandy because the Americans were planning to go up through Italy. Hmm. So Americans were never told about it, so they can hide anything. So when the American government doesn't want you to hear about it, they just don't report it.
Yeah, you know, I fully agree with that. Whatever they want to keep from us, they definitely, I believe they have the capabilities to do so and just not even talk about it, and it's a done deal.
Yeah, and but it would leak if it was aliens. I would argue that. It would just be too big a secret to hide. The reason that this stayed so well hidden was because it was such an embarrassment. People will keep quiet if it threatens their image, threatens their livelihood. And at a time where, again, I cannot overemphasize this, when the U.S. Army was trying to start a separate service branch that would take billions and billions of taxpayer dollars to support, you know, this is why the 21st century will be for biology what the 20th century was for physics, was because physicists have, in a very real sense, given it over to the biologists. And Emperor Hirohito anticipated that with his bacteriological weapons program. The biologists have not sold out the way the physicists have, because the physicists, not only did their weapons prove failures, but the physicists actually sold out to support this welfare state for physicists throughout the Cold War, in which their weapons were considered just ridiculously useless. If you take a look at the Americans in Dien Bien Phu, when President Eisenhower in 1954, spring of 1954, the French came up to him and said, we need three atomic bombs, drop them around Dien Bien Phu to relieve the siege from the Viet Minh. Eisenhower said, they aren't going to surrender. It didn't work on the Japs. And you can read about that in Operation Vulture. If you look up the words Operation Vulture on Google or search engine that talks about how Eisenhower turned down the French for a coordinated atomic attack on Dien Bien Phu because of his knowledge that the weapons had not worked in World War II and were essentially useless in terms of being a decisive weapon.
All right. Well, Douglas, I tell you what, man, we are right here at the end of the show where it's time to close it out. But give that website one more time for those who may have missed it. I know we had a few more come in there, and I'll stick in the chat room as well.
Sounds good. That'll be www.ufopilots.blogspot.com. And, you know, none of the pictures are necessarily self-explanatory, but if you listen to the audio that Mr. Greer has so kindly helped us to articulate, then it should give some meaning to most of the images that you see, or at least I hope it would. Mm-hmm. And I hope that Mr. Greer agrees with that.
You know, well, definitely. So, you know, and that, of course, this show will be available most likely tomorrow on the website, so you can always listen back to it and check out the website. But, Douglas, I really appreciate you joining us once again, and we look forward to having you back on sometime in the future as well.
I'm honored to be here, and glad to talk about plenty of other subjects. Certainly, Roswell is one that I have no doubt we'll have to return to in the future simply for some clarifications, at different times, because, as you know, the subject is so immense, it's very hard to cover it all, even with 3 hours.
Yeah, most definitely. So, and we'll definitely, make that happen. So, but thank you so much for joining us. It was, once again, a pleasure.
Thank you. We couldn't do it without the amazing service that you're presenting to the community. Thank you for what you do.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Well, have a good night, Douglas, and then we'll talk to you later.
Sounds good. Take care.
All right, everybody. That was Douglas Dietrich. Very interesting stuff. And I guess, Douglas does put a lot of information out there. And he does, pretty quickly. It is a lot of information. He tries to squeeze it in with the time that we give him. But I think what you're looking at there is you're looking at a lot of backstories leading up to Roswell. I mean, even when we look at everyday life, there are many different things that play a part to where we are today. And I believe that's what we get from Douglas, is a lot of the backstories of the backstories, I guess maybe the best way to describe it. But anyway, very interesting stuff, definitely. There are, it's up to you to do the research and figure out what it is you believe or not believe. But I do want to say it is great to see such a turnout in the chat room, and that does feel good after everything that we have been going through and, not broadcasting very much over the last few months, and finally coming back to hopefully what will be a regular schedule of every Sunday from 9 p.m. Eastern time to midnight. So don't look for Thursday shows anymore. I know it still says it on the website, but remember, we're going to be launching a new website, and to keep down the workload, we're not going to be updating this one right now. Hopefully the next one should be up in a couple of days or so. I really hope so. Definitely by the next show. And we'll have all the archives posted from the last 3 years. All the 24-hour bashes. We'll hopefully going to be adding a lot of some new features and new segments to the show. And I'll tell you what, I'll go ahead and kind of share with one I had in mind. Somebody's telling me to stop setting deadlines. Yes, I know. I really need to stop doing that. We'll just say we'll get the website up when it happens. But no, one of the new features that I'm really hoping to add to the show, and I thought it might be a little fun, is at some point near the middle to end of the show, we'll take about 30 minutes, maybe more along the lines of about 15 minutes, and we'll have a poll up during the entire show in which you can, more or less, we'll vote on a topic that we want to talk about for 15 minutes. Kind of a little open lines, open forum kind of deal. If somebody wants to call in and join in the discussion, they're more than welcome to. If the guest that we have on at that time wants to hang around and talk about it, they will be more than welcome to. Of course, if nobody wants to, you know I can ramble on for quite some time. And I have no problem sharing my views and opinions on whatever the subject matter is that is chosen for that night. So I thought that might be a little fun, a little something interesting to do. So, hopefully we'll have that implemented here within the next few shows and a few other things that I've been thinking about. I'm ready to get back to just having fun, sharing information, talking to interesting people, and just having a good time. I really, really miss being behind this microphone on a regular basis. And I tell you, I can't express how much I appreciate such a turnout and such a wonderful group of supporters, listeners, fans, readers, the whole nine yards we have out there. Thank you so much for that. So I'll tell you what, we're going to get out of here, and we will see you Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time to midnight, where we will have Dennis Crenshaw on, as a matter of fact, as a guest. I'm not sure. We have got some more of the show to book as well, so we'll figure that out. Hey, we're just going with the flow right now. But I'll leave you with this, a good old classic Shadows in the Dark outro, and that is, always remember to be watchful of those shadows in the dark. Good night, everyone.
Shadows in the dark.